You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, guns and butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
The only way we can get these bad guys is to be worse than them, to be more devious. And that's how crime and law enforcement become indistinguishable. And the tactics that are used in crime and law enforcement are exactly the same, except that one group wears the mantle of legitimacy.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Douglas Valentine. Today's show, how the CIA corrupts the system. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, about the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology with Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. Today we discuss his latest book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Douglas Valentine, welcome again.
Thank you for having me on your show.
In your new book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, you've written that the collusion between crime and law enforcement is the glue that holds the system together. You say that this is the case for small towns all the way up to the federal government. How does this system of collusion between crime and law enforcement operate? And why is this the case? You asked the question, is having people who are in actuality war criminals in positions of legislative and executive authority in America an expression of a free society? What are some examples of war criminals in positions of authority in America? For example, Major General Bruce Lawler. You wrote a chapter on him. Who is he?
Well, when I was doing my research in my book, The Phoenix Program, I met a bunch of CIA officers and they told me what they did. And Bruce Lawler was one of them. And he was a guy that he was going to college in Washington, D.C., and he got recruited into the CIA. And this was during the Vietnam War. And he was sent for training. He learned how to be both an agent handler, which is a specific job description in the CIA. There's agent handlers, but he also learned how to be a paramilitary officer, which are people that shoot guns and blow things up, and organize paramilitary units in foreign countries. And then around 1970, he was sent over, 71, he was sent over to Vietnam to work for more senior CIA officers doing these things. One of his jobs as a liaison officer was working with what was called the special branch of the South Vietnamese police. They are sort of comparable to our FBI, the special branch of the police. They were involved in trying to penetrate the insurgency at the highest levels. The Viet Cong insurgency had a political apparatus. You could think of them as the Democrats and the Americans and their allies as the Republicans and the CIA and its allies and the special police and the South Vietnamese army and its politicians were like Republicans, and they could not tolerate anybody who was a communist. They were after trying to find all the Democrats, all the communists in South Vietnam, and they would penetrate that organization through informants and also secret agents who would become part of it. They weren't really all that interested necessarily in arresting these people, but they were interested in being able to manipulate them, to be able to say, well, we know where your family lives. If you're not good, we'll go bump off your family. So because in Vietnam, for example, all the communists knew who the special policemen were and where their families were. So you couldn't go around bumping off each other's families, or you'd have like with the mafia, there was, you don't kill another man's wife and kids, you just keep it with yourself. So that was sort of like a rule. Anyway, Lawler found himself as a very young man, maybe 24, 25 years old, in a very important position. He was a liaison to a special police officer, and that special police officer ran an interrogation center where people who were suspected of having ties to the communists were brought for interrogation. And his job was to be there and to watch what would happen and report on it back to his bosses. And when I was talking with Lawler, he was very upset about the things he saw and about how his bosses behaved. It's now into 1972, 73. There's been a ceasefire signed, and supposedly the war has stopped. And yet these kind of very, devious and deadly kind of assassinations and interrogations and torture were still going on, and they weren't supposed to be going on anymore. And Lawler was very upset. One day he walked into this interrogation center, and there was a woman laid out on a table, and she'd been murdered and raped. And he saw that, the special policeman had murdered this woman, and he was just stunned. He didn't know what to do. I mean, it's a crime. Obviously, it's a crime. And he reported it, and he was told, forget about it. We can't control what the South Vietnamese do. Don't make an issue of it. Other things like that were happening to him, and he was witnessing his boss. And he explained all this to me. His boss was a very senior CIA officer, and he was in charge of Da Nang City, which is up in I Corps. And Bruce, through his Lawler, through his agent net, knew that this guy's girlfriend was a Viet Cong agent. And he went to his senior CIA boss and he said, "Look, I know your girlfriend's working for the enemy." And he told me, but they knew the war was winding down, and they just wanted to live a good life. This CIA, old-time CIA guy, was his last tour. He was going to retire. It wasn't uncommon in Vietnam for a senior, the Vietnamese special police, to actually bring a young 14, 15-year-old girl to a CIA officer every night. Different one. It's different culture, and these kinds of things and inducements were available. And when you're a CIA officer and you're everything you do is secret, you don't have to put that into a report. And of course, because you're protected and nobody can ever bring you before court in the United States, you can do anything illegal you want and you can get away with it. And all it takes is an old boy network of each of these guys knowing that this is how it works, and that, all they have to do is cover for each other and they can get away with it. They're getting away with it all over the world every day in a million ways. And that's how that old boy system works. But Bruce Lawler was only 24 years old, 25 years old. And he hadn't yet got assimilated into this old boy culture. And he actually went to the security officer in Saigon and, reported about the rape and the murder of this woman and about his senior boss being involved in having a girlfriend who was part of the enemy infrastructure. And within a week, Bruce Lawler was sent home. Okay? The security forces within the CIA, within the FBI, they don't exist to enforce rules or laws. They exist to enforce the old boy network and to allow these guys to get away with this. I mean, and if you, the worst thing that you can do, ask somebody like Snowden or John Kiriakou Kirikou ended up spending a couple of years in prison because all he did was mention another CIA officer's name. The one thing you can't do in the CIA is, rat out all the corruption that's going on. It's just like being in the NYPD. You can rip off people left and right all day long. The one thing you can't do is break the code of silence. And that's the same thing that's going on in the CIA. And that's why I said at the beginning of this conversation that if you're successful because you lie, steal, and cheat and murder, well, those become the things that you're going to use in their bureaucracy. And that's exactly what happens. But you can't know about it because these are secret organizations. And supposedly they're secret because they're doing all this good work overthrowing Russia or something, but it's really just to preserve all the prerogatives and the freedoms that they have in the security services themselves or in the police force themselves. And they rationalize it by saying, well, we have to live these lives because we're on the front lines and we get very small paychecks and we have to supplement our incomes somehow. A cop says, well, I can't send my kids to college on the paycheck I get. So if I want to send my kids to college, well, then I got to let the Jamaicans beat up the Colombians and take over the drug trade in my neighborhood. And then because the drug trade is going to go on anyway, so I got to let somebody do it. So, somebody's going to give me some money, then I can send my kids to college. So all these things go into it. Anyway, at the same time, in order to become part of this old boy network, whether it's in the NYPD or the FBI or the CIA, as happened to Lawler, you have to give up a part of yourself. And Lawler went through all this training, and he really believed in fighting communism. And even though he got sent back home after reporting on all the corruption he saw, and even though they actually kicked him out of the CIA, there was a part of him that always longed to get back in. And a couple of years later, he actually went back down to Washington, D.C., and Lawler's from Vermont. And he went to see William Colby, who was also brought up in Vermont. And Colby tried to get him back into the CIA, and it didn't really work. So he went back into the he'd been a reserve officer in the military. But he wanted to be part of this. So Colby helped him getting back into the military, and all of a sudden, through the 1990s, he started rising very quickly through the military. And by 1999, he was actually in general, heading a special joint coordination force within NATO or something. I can't remember exactly, but he had given up his law practice and become a full-time military officer. He was a general. And when the Department of Homeland Security was created in 2001, Bruce Lawler became its chief of staff. And all of a sudden, you have a guy who's still trying to prove, whose personal motivation is to prove that he really is one of the old boys, that he's sorry that he ratted out all his bosses back there in Vietnam. Please give me a chance, and I'll show you guys that I'm really one of you. Now, he gets appointed chief of staff of the Department of Homeland Security when it's created. And all sorts of people were complaining about because they didn't understand what he was doing, and they couldn't understand why he was doing certain things. And I wrote him a letter. It was actually an open letter, which was published in Counterpunch about a week after he got appointed to this position. And I said, hey, Bruce, are you still working for the CIA? I mean, are you a CIA plant in the Department of Homeland Security? Are you actually working for them? And are you, helping to organize this new organization in a way that makes it possible for the CIA to infiltrate them and to place people that it wants in positions of power there? And of course, that was, again, I didn't come up through the Columbia School of Journalism. I just, you know, asked it, you know, and of course he never responded, but you don't know. You know, a guy like him could always be, even if he's not actually a CIA officer, so ideologically in sync with them and has the context, I mean, that he could actually be a CIA asset at the highest level of the Department of Homeland Security. And if you think it doesn't happen, think again, because it does happen. And there was an awful lot of people from the Phoenix program and from the CIA who moved out of the CIA, either into positions of to hold public office or into law enforcement or the DEA or the FBI or some other organization, who maintain their CIA contacts, come up through another channel and find themselves in the Department of Homeland Security. And certainly the ideology, as they are, it infects the whole thing of the only way we can get these bad guys is to be worse than them, to be more devious. And that's how crime and law enforcement become indistinguishable. And the tactics that are used in crime and law enforcement are exactly the same, except that one group wears the mantle of legitimacy, you know, and the other, you know, they're the immigrants or the outcasts who are just trying to get into the establishment, and they don't have lawyers writing tax laws, you know, to get them off of like a guy like Trump. You know, so he doesn't have to pay $1 billion in taxes that he owes, which, of course, is a much bigger crime than anything that that the minions are doing, you know, that the nobodies are doing that are getting arrested and put in jail. You know, I mean, the massive crime is conducted systematically, like I quote that fellow at the beginning of my book saying, you know, the violence of guns is for the amateur. You know, the violence of aircraft carrier fleets, of nuclear weapons, of Department of Justice that's essentially racist. You know, that kind of violence, that kind of terror. Well, that's the problems of our rulers. And it's all legal because they make it legal for them to do it. And yet it's no less criminal to be not paying $1 billion in taxes. Just as you're a billionaire, that's what you're allowed to do. Anyway, so I could go on and on with there's all sorts of in this book, the CIA organized crime. I present a couple of cases of people who worked for the CIA or special forces and then carry this whole philosophy with them into their public life.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, How the CIA Corrupts the System. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You also comment in your book that you observe that the personality traits of criminals and those who go into law enforcement or the CIA or whatever, that they have very similar personality traits.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I interviewed a man named Nelson Brickham, who was the guy who created the Phoenix program. I think I might have told you about him in our previous interview. And Brickham was, you know, I mean, so some of these people are funny, you know? I mean, and they were very forthcoming with me because they thought, you know, because William Colby sent me, you know, that it was okay to tell me everything. And Brickham said it was his feeling, based on 20 years of experience, that the average CIA officer was just a frustrated mercenary, a guy who, if he wasn't educated, hadn't gone to Harvard or Yale or Columbia, and hadn't joined the CIA, would have been a mercenary. This is CIA officers telling me this. And he wasn't the only one. When you meet these guys, whether they're in the DEA, you know, I mean, a DEA guy who goes undercover into the Medellin cartel, you know, you can't fake it. You can't join a drug trafficking organization and fake it. You know, I mean, you've got to have in you the larceny. You got to have the psychopathology. You got to be a bit of a sociopath. And it's the same thing with the CIA. I mean, I have some of those traits myself, I confess. And that's one of the reasons these guys liked me. I could walk into a room with them, you know, in a bar and have a couple of drinks, and we could look at each other and say, let's cause some trouble, you know, let's see what we can get away with. If I wasn't that way, if I had been a good guy, they never would have trusted me and talked to me. You got to be somewhat felonious in order for them to even begin to trust you. You can't ride with a cop in a patrol car if he thinks you're going to rat him out. You know, I mean, you're out the door. So anyway, Brigham said this to me, and it was my experience, having known all these guys, federal narcotic agents, cops, CIA officers, that it's absolutely true. And there is no really difference between a CIA officer who can go and wipe out a family or send somebody to go wipe out a family, because it's what the CIA calls psychological warfare. And it's going to suppress the bad guys. They know that we're going to go get your family and we're going to wipe them out. And they think it's funny. You know, we can do this and we can get away with it. And that's the mentality that these people exhibit. And they can't rat it out. And they ideologically, they become so indoctrinated that they think that when they commit crimes, it's okay. They think they're above the law.
What is the relationship between the Drug Enforcement Administration, that is the DEA, and the CIA? Is it as simple, at least at one point, as the DEA fighting drug trafficking and the CIA promoting it?
It's a long history that evolves to some extent. Okay. Nowadays, the DEA is basically an adjunct overseas of the CIA. And of course, Afghanistan is the showcase example. The Taliban, when it took power in 1999 or 2000, first thing it did was it outlawed opium production. And the amount of opium coming out of Afghanistan decreased. After the CIA took over in 2002, opium production in Afghanistan skyrocketed. And it has become, since the CIA took over in Afghanistan and the military started occupying that country, for the last 15 years, Afghanistan has provided like 90% of the heroin to the United States. You can believe the published reports that the DEA puts out, and it says, well, it's the Taliban did it. You know, I mean, but it's like, you know, your dog pees on your rug, and then you come in and he says, well, the Russians did it. You know, I mean, you can believe your eyes or you can believe what they're reporting to you. But it's in a country like Afghanistan, the DEA serves a function of making sure that the warlords on the CIA's payroll are able to deal narcotics. If somebody in the Taliban tries to deal narcotics, then the DEA descends on them. But it's political. It's totally political, and it's considered national security. It's more important for the United States to have political control of Afghanistan. And the only way they can have political control is if they deal with gangsters who deal narcotics and are willing to sell out their own country in order to make a couple of million dollars. And then, you know, later on, you know, get construction deals. You know, they're diversified. The warlords that are on the CIA's payroll, you know, I mean, they speculate in the market. They are involved in vast, you know, always funneling their illegal narcotic profits into legitimate enterprises, you know, and they make, build up a political party and control the country. But that's how it works. And it worked that way in I should say, South Vietnam used to be the absolute example of this. And I discovered this while investigating the Phoenix program. For example, I was talking once with this guy named Robert Slater. And he ran the interrogation program in South Vietnam with the special police that I mentioned earlier. The CIA paid to have an interrogation center built in each of the 44 provinces in South Vietnam. And it was this guy Slater's job, and he had a team of Americans he worked with to train the South Vietnamese special policemen who staffed these interrogation centers. And he would inspect them, and he would ride around with a team of special branch officers, and they would go to this province or that province, and they would, you know, inspect these interrogation centers and make sure everybody was writing reports properly and manning the outposts properly, all the different things. It was a bureaucracy. I remember Slater telling me that this the team that he traveled around the country with, they all smoked opium on the Air America planes when they were flying around. The Vietnamese did not think about opium the way we think about opium. You know, these are like they are FBI agents, and they're smoking opium on their way to inspect an interrogation center. It's a bizarre situation there in South Vietnam. It was part of the culture to smoke opium. They didn't have a lot of pharmacies and have a lot of doctors. Rural people would smoke opium, to reduce pain for certain, as medicine. The whole society was permeated it. And in order to keep the generals and the politicians and the policemen that were on their payroll, the CIA had to allow these people to dabble in narcotics and to actually import tons of opium from Laos, where it was grown and where the CIA actually had an army that it financed through the growing of opium. And then it was sold to people in South Vietnam. So, they controlled the CIA, controlled both ends of the operation. It grew it and made money, supported its army in Laos by growing it and then selling it to the South Vietnamese, who then sold it to American soldiers. Addiction in South Vietnam became a huge problem for the army. But if they, and again, here's the relationship between crime and law enforcement. If the CIA didn't control the opium trade, then the Viet Cong would have controlled it. And then they would have made the money from it. And then they would have been able to buy politicians. So the CIA was forced, or at least they say they were forced through the reality of the situation to control the opium trade. And that's what they did. They monopolized it. And that's what they do all over the world. They monopolized the opium trade internationally for the same exact reasons they did it in South Vietnam and the same reason they do it in Afghanistan. Because if they don't control it, then the bad guys, the people that they think are their enemies, will control it. They'll make the money and they'll control the underworld and be able to buy their politicians and put their people in place to control the political and social movements. And that's the reality. And the DEA, like I said, is an adjunct overseas of this policy. And any report you read is totally fabricated that says anything otherwise.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, How the CIA Corrupts the System. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Speaking of the drug trade in South Vietnam, you wrote an article called The Clash of Icons. What was that about?
Well, when you do a book like I did on the CIA, you find out all sorts of things that don't actually make it into the book. And as I told you the last time we spoke, I got entree into the CIA through William Colby, who was a director of Central Intelligence. And just briefly, he was a person that ran the Phoenix program in South Vietnam for a couple of years, went back to the United States and became director of Central Intelligence. He liked me. I went to approached him around 1984, told him I wanted to write a book about Phoenix. For some reason, he liked me, and he started introducing me to CIA people that he thought would be very helpful to me. And he introduced me to a guy named Frank Scotton. And Frank Scotton is this tremendously charismatic character. He's from Boston. His father was killed in World War II in the Battle of the Bulge or something like that. And he's a very patriotic guy. He went to American University, where he graduated around 1960, 1961. He went to the East-West Center in Hawaii around 1961, where he learned how to run agent nets. I was told he joined the United States Information Service, the USIS, which is the overseas branch of the United States Information Agency. And in late 1961, early 1962, Frank Scotton ended up in Vietnam. And Colby sent me to Scotton because Scotton was a pioneer in developing a couple of the programs that were incorporated into the Phoenix program 5 years later. One of those programs was called Armed Propaganda Teams. When Scotton got to Vietnam in 1962, we weren't at war with the country yet. And he was put way up in the highlands working with Montagnards, mountain people who were kind of looked down upon by the Vietnamese. And there was a bunch of Brits there. The Brits were kind of, they were the experts on how to organize indigenous people because they had done that in Malaysia. And he fell under the influence of these Brits. And he started getting involved in these very, very clandestine kind of psychological warfare operations where they adopted communist techniques of trying to promote the government line in villages, understanding that the communists had infiltrated this area. And Scotton was trying to set up programs that would convince the people to come over to the government side. Going into these remote villages, I remember he told me once they would drop leaflets or, tell people that, you know, we're going to bring you democracy. And they were on the outskirts of a village. And he shot a flare gun into the sky at night. And they yelled, "Walk to the light." You know, like the Bible begins, you know, "Let there be light." You know, they were trying to find ways to convince very rural people to come over to the side of the government. And Scotton put these armed propaganda teams together. And these armed propaganda teams had a component that was called a counterterror team. And they would go into a village where the communists had influence and had put a communist agent in the village in order to control the behaviors of the people in that village. And Scotton's counterterror team would pull them into the middle of the village and say, "We know this guy works for the communists," and they would chop his head off and put it on a stake. And they would say, "If you do this sort of stuff, if you, you know, collaborate with the communists, this is going to happen to you." And they say that they were doing this because the communists were doing it, and they had to do it. If they were going to compete with the communists, they had to be as brutal as them. This counter-terror facet of Scotton's armed propaganda teams became one of the two foundation stones of the Phoenix program. This counter-terror, you know, being able to go into enemy villages with small units and commit atrocities. That was one of the two foundation stones, the other being the interrogation centers that I was just telling you about. Anyway, so Scotton was widely known within the CIA and the intelligence community in South Vietnam for having devised these programs. In 1965, a young Marine Corps captain named Dan Ellsberg was sent to Vietnam. And Ellsberg was sent to work with a guy named General Lansdale, who was in charge of what was called the Revolutionary Development Program in Vietnam at that time. that Revolutionary Development Program had incorporated Scotton's armed propaganda teams as its centerpiece and its counterterrorism function, and was expanding it just like with the interrogation centers. It started out of a little village here and a district there, and they were making it national in 1965. And the Pentagon sent Daniel Ellsberg out to work with Lansdale and Scotton and to observe and report on how this revolutionary development program was playing out. And Dan Ellsberg lived with Frank Scotton for a year, and they were best friends. Anyway, Colby sent me to interview Scotton, you know? And I was talking with Scotton about all these programs that he put together and which I wrote about extensively. And out of the blue, he said, oh, and by the way, I lived with Dan Ellsberg for a year. I said, you mean the Dan Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers? He said, oh, yeah. You know, Dan was one of us. All these things that we did, all these kind of like really clandestine operations where you go out and you put on black pajamas like the Viet Cong, and you go into a village and you hunt down the enemy cadres. Well, Dan went along with us. He did all that stuff with us. And not only that, he said Dan was quite the ladies' man. And he told me a story, which I should say was corroborated by a couple of other people. I mean, Scotton wasn't the only one I was talking to. Talking with another guy, Lou Conine, I don't want to be redundant, but these stories were all corroborated by a lot of people. Dan was quite what they called that day, a swordsman. And like I told you earlier, just like opium is considered different in South Vietnam, it was a different culture. Well, you know, relations between men and women were also more liberal. Just like I said, it was the South Vietnamese would bring young women to high-ranking CIA officers. There was a it just isn't like it is here. There were not a lot. The rules were a lot looser. And anyway, Dan was having a field day, and one of the women that Dan Ellsberg got involved with was a young woman named Germaine. And Germaine was one quarter French and three quarters Vietnamese. She was connected with a whole group of French Corsicans, some of whom had been trafficking in opium in South Vietnam and Laos for many years. And Dan started a relationship with this young woman, Germaine, even though he knew that she was the girlfriend of a Corsican drug trafficker named Miguel Seguin. And this is in the summer of 1965. Scotton was telling me the story, and he said, well, it almost blew up the entire underworld, this relationship. And this guy, Michel Seguin, let it be known that he was going to kill Dan. And he said, the stories about how it actually unfolded are slightly different, but they're all basically the same thing. Michel Seguin sent an assassin to kill Dan Ellsberg because he was romancing his girlfriend. And Scotton and Lou Conine, Conine, who had been in the CIA for 20 years at that point, 15, 20 years, actually had to go to the Corsican underworld and tell him to back off and not kill Dan, or else there would be a gang war in Saigon between the CIA and the Corsicans. Okay, so it's a fabulously interesting story, and I asked Dan Ellsberg about it, and he said, well, he had a slightly different version of it. He said that this guy Seguin actually came to the villa where he lived with Scotton and put a gun to his head and said, stay away from my girlfriend, I'll kill you. And then I asked Dan Ellsberg, well, were the Corsicans dealing drugs? Was the CIA involved in that aspect of the underworld? And he flatly denied it. He said that his boss, Ed Lansdale, General Ed Lansdale, who he really admired, and he considered mentor. Lansdowne had been in the Philippines in the early 1950s, and he had put down the communist insurrection there. And then in 54, he was sent to South Vietnam to do the same thing. And he's Lansdowne, the guy that put ZM in power. Lansdowne was there until 1958. And Conine, Lew Conine, was with Lansdowne that whole time. Conine came back to South Vietnam around 61 or 62. Conine was the guy who was the liaison between the CIA and the generals that assassinated ZM in 1963. Conine was still there in 65 when Lansdowne came back. So you had Lansdowne, Conine, Scott, and Ellsberg all working together. There's a very famous photograph of Conine and Ellsberg in a boat together. But when it comes to the CIA and drugs, Dan says, no, there was no relationship. Whereas Conine told Al McCoy, who wrote a very famous book called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, that in 1965, the CIA actually made a deal with the Corsicans that not to interfere in their drug running as long as the Corsicans served as informants for the CIA. So I wrote this article that gets very elaborate, and it's called The Clash of the Icons. Do you believe, on the one hand, Dan Ellsberg, who worked intimately with all these CIA guys for many years, and saying that there no, the CIA wasn't involved in drugs, or do you believe Al McCoy, who spent many years researching the subject and shows beyond any doubt that the CIA was controlling the whole business, you know, and it documented the whole thing. You know, I mean, who are you going to believe? And the other thing that Scott told me, which was kind of controversial, was that he had actually put Ellsberg up to releasing the Pentagon Papers. And I asked Dan about that as well. And he said, no, it absolutely wasn't true. That Scott, when I saw him, was, sort of laughed. And he said, we are the ones that put Ellsberg up releasing the Pentagon Papers. And we, meaning Colby and him, I didn't ask anything more about it at the time, but I did ask Dan about it. He denied it again. And apparently he already had the Pentagon Papers in his possession when, in late 1970, when Scott showed up at his house and saw the Pentagon Papers there. And it may have, you know, there may have been some conversation about it at that point, but in an autobiography that he wrote recently, Scott denies having put Ellsberg up to do it, although he did tell me that they did. So anyway, you come across these kind of things, and they're the kind of insights into what the CIA does in terms of corrupting foreign officials. Like, for example, Neil Sheehan was part of this group, the New York Times reporter. He was there. He knew Scott. He knew Ellsberg back in those days. Halberstam was there. They knew these guys intimately. They partied together. They knew everything that was going on at this very intimate level, and yet they didn't report on it. You know, they didn't talk about this kind of aspect of how CIA officers in their private lives, the kinds of things that they were involved in, the way that they would integrate into the culture, the way they would work and maneuver through the underworld, how they would spy on the special policemen or the hit teams that they were working on, how, you know, they would spy on them and talk back to the CIA about these things, because you're not allowed to report anything about the CIA. So there's this whole secret history of the Vietnam War that exists at this very intimate level that nobody ever knows about or has ever heard about. And the story that I wrote about Ellsberg, which I confirmed it all, you know, I did talk to him and tell him everything, you know, for his opinions. It's just a part of our history. is a part of world history that nobody ever gets to know. And the only way you ever get to know about it is if these guys accept you into their old boy network. And the only way that they're going to do that is if you're as felonious as they are, and if they really think that you're like them, you know. And I guess that was one of the characteristics I had. I didn't mind making some trouble if that's what it took, you know. So anyway, that's that story. And it involves the CIA's involvement in narcotic trafficking. That's what's at the center of it.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, How the CIA Corrupts the System. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And what about Al McCoy, the author that you referred to in your story, The Clash of Icons, who wrote about the trafficking in heroin in Southeast Asia? Did anything happen to him on account of having done that research and written that book?
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, everybody knows about Gary Webb, the guy who did the expose on the CIA's involvement with the Contras. And Gary Webb was denounced by the American media for having exaggerated and made a few little small mistakes and lost his job and ended up allegedly committing suicide out of despair. Well, McCoy suffered, too. The CIA tried to prevent his book from being published. One of the guys who was very senior in the CIA at the time, named Cord Meyer, who had run the CIA's Operation Mockingbird, which was the CIA's effort to control the media in the United States, which started in the 50s and went through the 60s and was exposed by Bernstein around 74. This guy, Cord Meyer, went to the publisher, McCoy's publisher, who he knew from school. You know, I mean, they went foxtrotting together and hanged out at the same Georgetown social circles. You know, I think I explained to you last time that at the highest levels, the CIA and the media are the same people, whether it's the CIA and the publishing industry or the CIA and Hollywood. They're the same people. There's no distinction. And so Cord Meyer didn't want the book to be published. And he went to McCoy's publisher and asked him not to do it. And to his credit, the guy said, no, let the book come out. But McCoy was so hounded. And a lot of the CIA officers that he interviewed changed their stories and said, no, I didn't say that. You know, I would never say that. And McCoy ended up having to leave in the United States and went and lived in Australia for 10 years. Thought he'd never get another book published here. You know, I mean, if you reveal the CIA's secrets, especially about its biggest, darkest secret, which is his control of international drug trafficking, you're going to pay a price. And basically, the first price is that nobody will ever publish you again in the United States. It's hard. Believe me, you know, the CIA kept a file on me. And they did everything they could to try to prevent my book from coming out. When I started doing my research into the CIA's involvement in drug trafficking, it was in basically in the early 1990s. And there were still a lot of DEA officers who were resisting the CIA through the again, systems analysis theory. The CIA has been able to take over by placing people who sympathize with it or who are actually CIA officers into the DEA over a period of 25, 30 years. They were actually able to take over the DEA senior management. They were able to take over its intelligence and foreign operations. They infiltrated the DEA. I talk about that in my books, how they did it, how they did it through, you know, manipulating Congress and having the right political people put in. There's just a million ways, and they use them all. But in 1994, just to give you an example, I got an interview with a guy who was the acting administrator of the DEA at that time, a guy named Steve Green. And he didn't want to do the interview. But his public affairs chief, a guy named Bill Ruzzamenti, set up the interview for me. That's kind of funny because I took a plane down that morning. I got a train. It was snowing. I had two suitcases with me. I was wearing this big London fog raincoat. And I took a train to Pentagon City, and I walked into the DEA business building carrying two suitcases and wearing this trench coat. Obviously, this was before 9/11. And nobody bat an eye. I went to the front desk and I'm here to see Ruzumene. And they called up and Ruzumene came down in the elevator. And I got into the elevator with my bags and my coat. And we went up to the executive suite where this guy, Steve Green, had his office. And Ruzumene sat me down, got me a cup of coffee. And he said, I'm going to tell you something. And if you ever tell anybody, I'll deny it. He said, but yesterday the CIA called up and they told us not to go through with this interview with you. They said, the CIA said to us, Valentine's trying to get at us through you. Don't talk to him. Now, in a free society, this sort of thing wouldn't happen, you know, but it's an old boy network. And they were following me around and they were surveilling me and they knew everybody I was going to see, and they were always trying to get people not to talk to me, which, of course, is an infringement on my First Amendment rights. But anybody who gets into the investigating the CIA should understand from the beginning you don't have any rights. And I understood that. And I was just willing to try and finesse my way through it. And Ruzumene said, so what do you have to say about that? I said, well, Bill, I'm writing a book about the DEA, but if I find out that the CIA was involved in any way or if they were interfering in your operations, I'm going to write about that. And he said, great, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. Nowadays, that doesn't work anymore. There is no more. There are no more Bill Ruzumentes in the DEA. There are no more people who are resisting the CIA in this absolutely total corruption of the entire bureaucratic system within the United States. It doesn't exist anymore. I absolutely loathe Donald Trump, but he is expressing with his recent battle with the CIA, the fact that there is this old boys club that has been completely corrupted within, that is managing the system. And when he says the system's rigged, he's right. It totally is. And the CIA is at the heart of it. And they've taken over every institution in the country that in any way has anything to do with foreign operations. Because in the world that we live in today, there really is no more distinction between domestic and foreign operations. Everything is integrated and in so many ways. And, Trump represents in his sort of nativist way an effort to, like Brexit, to retain some kind of integrity to a state itself and to take back, control over your own fate, rather than having these internationalists, TPP and all that stuff, selling your jobs away and stuff like that. Now, of course, it's all rhetoric with Trump. I have no idea whether he actually, intends to do any of these things. He's a billionaire, but it really is true. And they have taken over. They've taken over in the same way that they've taken over the DEA. They've taken over Homeland Security, as I was explaining to you earlier, with the appointment of these guys like Lawler. And I've taken over the Homeland Security, again, because the threat of terrorism, it's not just a domestic thing. It can't be. There's no way to separate it out from what's going on overseas. So the CIA has to be involved because they're the only ones that know what's going on overseas in these ways. So everything's become integrated. And the only people that really have all the knowledge about what's going on overseas and are able to control it and have been putting in the systems of control for the last 75 years is the CIA. And that cabal of good old boys that have really, really just taken over the security services, and they use it like a mafia to fatten themselves. and their sponsors, and many of whom are in the arms industry, and have nothing to gain by peace around the world and having peaceful relations with China or Russia or any other country. They make their money through conflict, and the CIA is the tool that provokes the conflicts all around the world. And that's why it's clandestine, is because it's serving this function. And the United States at this point in its history has become totally dependent on that system of provoking conflicts and having conflict that is totally irrational and unnecessary, other than serving these people who control this system.
Douglas Valentine, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear.
There's a man with a gun over there. I've been speaking with Douglas Valentine. Today's show has been How the CIA Corrupts the System. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, About the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology, With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. His latest book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, available at claritypress.com. Visit his website at douglasvalentine.com. That's douglasvalentine.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of light, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. It's Potpourri number 5 today, featuring a press review, Noam Chomsky, Ralph Nader, and some music. As they say on Debbie Does Dallas, we have something for everyone, and everybody likes something. I hope you'll stay tuned. This is Potpourri number 5. Potpourri is a lovely, fragrant term, which means a bit of this and a bit of that. Potpourri sounds a little nicer than hodgepodge, and sounds less ethnic than smorgasbord. Remember the term smorgasbord? Today we call it a buffet, which is easier to spell and pronounce, though still a foreign word. I've started a movement to bring back the good old Middle English word, hodgepodge. To further this important work, send your generous financial contribution to my offshore tax haven, New World Notes, care of Second National Bank of Trinidad and Tobago, Pembroke, Tobago. And great will be your reward in West Virginia, which is almost heaven, if you can believe their license plates. But for the moment, potpourri it is. We'll have our offbeat press review, music by David Rovix, and part of a nice interview of Noam Chomsky by Ralph Nader, two of my personal heroes. Let's start off with a press review. Fanfare, please. New World Notes' press review presents a hodgepodge of stories you might have missed. Nuggets of gold gleaned from the sewers of the corporate-controlled press. First off, I hope you celebrated National Lobster Day appropriately. Yes, if this week's Stop and Shop supermarket circular is to be believed, Monday, September 25, was National Lobster Day. I celebrated by visiting the lobster shelter at my local supermarket and adopting one. I took it for a walk, then took it to lunch at Popeye's. According to reports, the early 19th century French poet Gérard de Nerval had a pet lobster. He would walk the lobster on a leash on the grounds of the Palais Royal in Paris. Nerval once explained, quote, "Why should a lobster be any more ridiculous than a dog? I have a liking for lobsters. They are peaceful, serious creatures. They know the secrets of the sea. They don't bark, and they don't gobble up your privacy the way dogs do. Goethe hated dogs, and he wasn't crazy." Unquote. Nerval forgot to mention another benefit of adopting a lobster. When you get bored with your pet, you can kill him, cook him, and eat him. Sure, you can do that with your dog or horse, too. But then the SPCA and PETA and all the other bleeding heart liberals will get on your case and make life hell for you for several months. And the county will take your children and put them in foster homes. Kill and eat a lobster? At worst, PETA will give you a dirty look. The SPCA and child welfare won't bat an eyelash. So, a toast to our crustacean friends on National Lobster Day, September 25. Not all of the items in our press review are as up-to-date as the last one. This clipping has been hanging around for over a year. Big headline in my local daily paper, the Journal Inquirer of No Fixed Address. This story wins the Hubris Award, hands down. The headline is a quotation, in quotation marks. Quote, "We conquered Jupiter," unquote. Yes, a NASA Juno spacecraft did not explode on the launch pad and managed, after 5 years, to make it to the planet Jupiter. And it began orbiting the planet. Juno's chief scientist, Scott Bolton, announced, quote, "We're there. We're in orbit. We conquered Jupiter," unquote. Maybe you can think of a better example of hubris. I can't. You send a rocket into orbit, and then you announce that you have conquered the largest planet in the solar system? This from a country that was unable to conquer North Vietnam after 20 years of trying, and 10 years of seriously trying. This from a country that has been unable to conquer Afghanistan after 16 years of trying. Some mighty conqueror. Now we're claiming to have conquered a planet roughly 23 gazillion times the size of Afghanistan. A planet on which we've never set foot and shall not set foot in the foreseeable future, if ever. That's how we should have conquered Afghanistan. Fly a plane around it, never set foot in it, declare victory, go home and celebrate. Works for me. And it would have worked in Vietnam, too. But to compare great things with small, my local paper, the Journal Enquirer, is always publishing announcements like this one. This is a news story. And I quote, "Manchester will hold DUI checkpoint on Main Street." Manchester, the police department will be conducting a sobriety checkpoint on Main Street between Park and Oak Streets from 8 p.m. Friday until 2 a.m. Saturday. Officers will be looking for drivers who are impaired and unsafe to drive. Additionally, officers will be targeting dangerous driving behaviors, such as failing to wear seatbelts and using electronic devices while driving. Okay, that's the end of that article. Well, on behalf of drunks on wheels everywhere, thank you for the warning, officers. So if, like me, you plan to drive drunk through downtown Manchester this Friday night, perhaps texting as you weave back and forth, don't drive on that block of Main Street in front of St. James Church. Got it? Beware of the big white church on the left as you're weaving back and forth more or less northwards. That's where the checkpoint will be, according to the announcement. Intoxicated drivers, cell phone addicts, and people in stolen cars, remember to avoid Manchester's Main Street this Friday night only. Take Spruce Street instead. That's just one block to the east, parallel to Main, and that'll get you to the next tavern on your list in very little extra time. Thank you, Manchester Police Department, for helping to get drunk and distracted drivers off Main Street and onto Spruce Street, where the rents are lower. Your tax dollars at work. And drinkers, keep reading the Journal Enquirer for more advance warnings of when and where the cops will be stopping drunks like you next time. Seriously, dear listener, maybe you can figure out why the police give advance notice of when and where their drunk driving checkpoints will be. I give up. Okay, our press review has time for one more item. Let's see. Fire at Massachusetts Fire Station? Save that one for next time. Here's a crime report. The crime isn't a huge one, but I think the story reveals some important truths about how life is going for the citizens here in the land of steady habits. I'll suppress the scoundrel's name. The headline asks, "Pick on someone your own size?" A Derby man is facing charges that he pinned a 5-year-old boy to the ground during a Father's Day party. Shelton police say that the man, age 33, was attending a party at a daycare center last Friday when the child playfully took a card the man had received from his son. Police say the man chased the child, picked him up, and pinned him to the ground, screaming at him in front of the other children. When officers arrived, the man asked them to have the 5-year-old arrested, police said. The man was charged with risk of injury to a minor and disorderly conduct. And that's the press review for this week. With newspaper readership plummeting, you can depend on New World Notes to scour the provincial press for you and let you know what you've missed. Stay tuned from time to time for more installments of The Press Review. An even better way to catch up on current events is to listen to David Rovick's songs, especially with events that are happening in other countries. The corporate media will rarely tell you what's happening elsewhere in the world unless an American is killed or arrested, or American corporate profits are threatened, or a cute baby animal is born in a zoo in Lower Slobovia. Here's a big hubbub in England that I had never heard of until I heard the David Rovick song a couple of years ago. Big riots that started in the Tottenham neighborhood of North London, then spread to other London neighborhoods, then spread to other cities. Called the Tottenham riots for short. The riots lasted for 6 days, August 6 through 11, 2011. Thousands of people rioted. 3,000 were arrested and 1,000 were charged with crimes. This is bigger than any civil disturbance in the United States for decades. Maybe since the Los Angeles riots in 1992. And what touched off the Tottenham riot? A questionable police shooting of an unarmed black man, Mark Duggan. Sound familiar? Kind of strikes a chord, doesn't it? The problems of police violence, suppression of minorities, and growing anger among the suppressed are pretty common in our neoliberal, plutocratic age everywhere. David Rovick's song is titled "London is Burning."
Sitting in his car, they say he might have had a gun. What we know for sure is he had 5 kids, daughters and sons. Now he can't have a family, he'll never see his friends. His neighbors understand what kind of message this sends. Some life is worth less, some life is worth more. You don't have to be a mathematician to know the score. Some people get shot just for being who they are. Some people play with iPads, take vacations, drive in fancy cars. Some people go to universities, some people do not. It depends on where you were born and how much money you got. The government cuts their spending, widening the divide, then reacts with disbelief when they face the rising tide of anger at the cuts, at the futures that they rob. With each day, so many have to live without a job. Now the flames are getting hotter, maybe coming to your town. London is burning down. Cameron went on TV in his suit and tie. If the riots asked the question, then this was his reply. We'll arrest these hooligans, these people without shame. They are only criminals, and it's only criminals to blame. Morals have decayed among the peasants' ranks, so let us lock them up while we bail out the banks. When that's the way they look at it, it's not very hard to watch things fall apart in this house of cards. Now the flames are getting hotter, maybe coming to your town. as people whine. These kids have too much freedom, and all this is just a sign that we need more policemen to teach them some respect. Well, if that's your line, then I know just what you can expect. The class will be repeated until the lesson has been learned. All you need is some injustice to make your cities burn. All you need is the perception, whether or not it's true, that most of us will never live the way you do. Now the flames are getting hot, they need coming to your town. London is burning down.
World Notes continues with Potpourri number 5. There's a movie out on Netflix and a book to match. It's called Requiem for the American Dream, and it features Noam Chomsky. It's about the 10 ways the powers that be keep the average citizen subordinate and struggling and more or less powerless. Recently, Ralph Nader spent an hour interviewing Chomsky on these matters. Chomsky did most of the talking. We'll hear parts of his fascinating talk now and in future weeks on New World Notes. Here's the first installment.
Reduced democracy is quite important because people, if they had the chance, would never accept the programs that are being imposed. So therefore, you have to reduce democracy. Now, we have to put this a little bit in context. The 1950s and the 1960s were what are sometimes called the golden age of capitalism, which would be called state capitalism. There was the unprecedented high growth rate, and it was essentially egalitarian. So the lowest fifth of the population did about as well in growth as the highest fifth. There was very high taxation of wealth. There was a lot of government planning and intervention. In fact, the current high-tech economy, computers, internet, satellites, microelectronics, and so on, was mostly developed in large part through government coordination and subsidy in the 1950s and 60s. There was also one thing that was happening was an increase in democracy, substantial increase in democracy from the popular movements that were developing during this period. And as you know very well, there was a very sharp reaction to that. The reaction in the early 70s was crucially across the spectrum from conservatives to liberals. The conclusion was we have to reduce democracy. And there are some quite striking documents that bear on this. So one of them from the right was the so-called Powell Memorandum. Lewis Powell, a corporate lawyer working for the tobacco industries and others, later became a Supreme Court justice appointed by Nixon. He wrote a memorandum to the American Chamber of Commerce, you know, the business world. It was supposed to be confidential, but it quickly leaked, and it's quite interesting. What he was saying is, he said the whole country is being taken over by left-wing extremists, and he picked two who were the worst criminals. One of them was Herbert Marcuse, who was running the universities, and the other was Ralph Nader with his consumer safety programs and so on. So these two extreme leftist criminals were undermining the, you know, the free enterprise system and the business world and so on. And it went on with a kind of a long screed like this. But then his conclusion was, look, he said, we businessmen really own the country. We're the trustees of the universities. We're the people who have the resources. We should fight back and not let these hordes of young people and students and other activists overwhelm us. And so we have to fight back and take control. That was the right wing. The liberals are, in a way, more interesting. at roughly the same time, the first study came out from what's called the Trilateral Commission International. It's basically liberal internationalists from the three major industrial democratic centers, Europe, Japan, and the United States. The American rapporteur was Samuel Huntington, well-known Harvard professor. And they produced their political complexion is illustrated by the fact that they basically staffed the Carter administration. So that's where they're coming from in the United States, similarly the other industrial countries. Their book is called The Crisis of Democracy. And actually their conclusions are pretty similar to Powell's. It's much less hysterical rhetoric. It's more muted. It's more scholarly. But the essential is the same. They said in the 1960s, there's been too much democracy. Large parts of the population that traditionally are passive and apathetic and obedient are starting to be concerned with their own issues and problems, are trying to enter the political arena, are trying to participate more fully. And they say that's too much pressure on the state. The state can't respond to all these demands. Incidentally, they never mentioned the pressure from the corporate sector, which, of course, has overwhelming influence on the state. But that's okay. That's not a special interest. That's the national interest. We don't mention them. But the special interests, young people, old people, women, blacks, farmers, workers, they're getting too much involved in the political arena. So we need more what they call moderation in democracy. They have to go back to passivity and obedience. And they were particularly concerned with what Huntington called, what the whole group, in fact, called the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young. That's their phrase, incidentally, not mine. That means the schools, the universities, the churches, they're not indoctrinating the young properly. So we have to have more discipline and indoctrination in the educational and cultural system to prevent this excess of democracy. So here we have, this kind of symbolizes the general elite mood from right to what's called left, meaning moderately liberal. That's the basic mainstream establishment. The view is we have this too much democracy. It's undermining the business world, and in fact, the rate of profit was decreasing, and it's necessary to reverse this, to have more indoctrination, more passivity, and to undermine democracy. And pretty much that's what's been done.
You've covered the first two principles, reduce democracy and shape ideology, mentioning the Powell memorandum. And the third one is redesign the economy, where they actually put these strategies into place right down where people live, work.
Yeah. Well, the way you redesign the economy was by instituting the what are called the neoliberal programs, the Washington Consensus, it was sometimes called. It kind of started in the late Carter years. It took off with Reagan and pursued further by Clinton, expanded and on to the present. And this is worldwide, incidentally. It's an effort to reduce the role of the public, which means through the one institution that the public can participate in to some extent, namely the government. In principle and sometimes in practice, people can influence government decisions. So reduce the role of government and transfer it to what's called the market, which means, in effect, private concentrations of capital, corporate concentrations, a very limited market, but that's the idea. So, you know, Reagan's slogan was, government is the problem, not the solution. We have to turn things over to private power, in effect, private tyrannies, because the population has no direct input at all into the decision-making of the corporate sector. The relatively highly integrated systems of power that constitute the corporate sector with, you know, big banks on the boards of many corporations and all sorts of other kinds of integration and relative monopolization, not full, of course. And meanwhile, the financial institutions, one of the major features of the neoliberal period, has been an enormous growth of financial institutions and a change in their character. So if you go back to the 50s and 60s, the period of what's sometimes called regulated capitalism, great growth period, banks were banks. Banks were places where you could deposit some money. They would lend it to somebody for, say, starting a business or building a home or whatever. That's what banks were. They were also regulated by the New Deal regulations, so there were no financial crises. And they functioned as a central part of the state capitalist economy. Starting in the early 70s, that changed radically. Partly it was the breakdown of the whole Bretton Woods system, Nixon's the so-called Nixon shock, but all of this was coordinated. And one of the results was that financial institutions not only grew enormously in size, just exploded, but also changed radically in character. Instead of being connected to the real economy, they more and more were involved in speculation, it complicated the financial instruments, all the things that we've seen. And of course, the deregulation began, late Carter, but particularly Reagan and Clinton. Deregulation meant regular financial crises. Financial crises means the public bails out the big banks for their predatory activities. We saw this again in 2007, 2008.
Two great progressive voices of our time, Ralph Nader and Noam Chomsky. More of this will follow, God willing. Audio courtesy of the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. I have condensed and edited the audio a little. And as William Blake wrote about this very installment of our show back in 1793, enough or too much. And he's right. But if you believe the road of excess leads to the Palace of Wisdom, you can find more at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, urging illegitimi non-carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No shorthand.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, you'll hear the first part of a speech given by Canadian foreign policy analyst Stephen Gowans, discussing his new book, Washington's Long War on Syria. And that will be followed by some announcements of upcoming events and a new book by David Ray Griffin. Stephen Gowans goes deeper into what motivates the U.S. and its allies to attack and destroy not just Syria, but Iraq and Libya also. I learned some new things from listening to this speech. I think you will too. This is a recent speech he gave in New York City, sponsored by the Hands Off Syria Coalition. And here he is, Stephen Gowans.
Hello. So, this book, I should emphasize this, this book is a book about U.S. foreign policy. That's the principal reason this was written. It's an examination of U.S. foreign policy. What I'll do is I'll summarize the book for you in about 30 seconds, and then I'll elaborate on some of the themes in the book, and then I'll take you through a more detailed look at Washington's long war in Syria, the actual war rather than the book. So, let me start with the central idea. The central idea of this book is that the wealthy have, and this is not an unusual idea, it's hardly unique to me, but the wealthy have an inordinate influence on the formation of public policy in the United States, including foreign policy, most especially foreign policy. U.S. foreign policy is structured to promote and defend the interests of billionaire investors and shareholders of U.S. banks and corporations. Washington would like the land, the labor, the resources, the markets of the Arab and Muslim world to be used for the benefit of U.S. bankers, U.S. shareholders of large corporations. By contrast, Syria, under the leadership of Bashar al-Assad, the current president, and before him, his father, the previous president, Hafez al-Assad, wanted the land, labor, resources, and markets of Syria and the larger Arab world to be used for the uplift of Syrians and for the uplift of Arabs. So there's therefore a fundamental contradiction between U.S. foreign policy and the Syrian government. They seek antagonistic goals. This contradiction has been present since at least 1963. 1963 is when the Arab nationalists came to power in Syria. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And the United States has sought to resolve that contradiction in its favor for at least the last six decades. Hence the title of the book, Washington's Long War on Syria. A more fitting title may have been Wall Street's Long War on Syria, which indeed was the working title, and it's the title I wanted, but apparently publishers have some influence over matters like this, so it became Washington's Long War on Syria. Some people, including those who write reviews in Quill and Quire, which reviewed this book recently, and others who are enamored of the work of Noam Chomsky, say that this view is far too simple, that the conflict in Syria is much more complicated than that. But they usually stop there without explaining why they think that view is too simple. Well, let's hear the words of the great docent of the left, Noam Chomsky. What would he say? Chomsky writes in Towards a New Cold War that to understand imperialist wars or interventionist wars, quote, it is a good idea to begin by investigating the domestic social structure. Who sets foreign policy? What interests do these people represent? What is the domestic source of their power? This is precisely the questions that this book addresses. And the book is organized, or has various sub-themes organized in chapters. So let me take you through what those sub-themes are. The first chapter is titled The Den of Arabism. I really like that phrase, the Den of Arabism. It's not my phrase. And this first chapter is an examination of Arab nationalist ideology, which underlies the actions of the Syrian state and places it in conflict with the interests of Wall Street. That ideology and its hostility to the idea that Washington can and will lead a global order, a global economic order, a global political order, that ideology is best summed up by two phrases, one which comes from the Syrian constitution, the other which comes from the Syrian president. So let me tell you about the phrase that comes from the Syria's constitution. Syria's constitution defines the Syrian state as the beating heart of Arabism and the forefront of confrontation with the Zionist enemy and the bedrock of resistance against colonial hegemony in the Arab world. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has said, quote, Syria is an independent state working for the interests of its people, rather than making the Syrian people work for the interests of the United States. I said that the United States wants to lead a global economic order. That's not a motivation that I've attributed to Washington. In fact, Washington is quite open about this ambition. The phrase, the United States can and will lead a global order, comes directly from the United States' 2015 National Security Strategy. It is a fascinating document, and it's readily available on the internet, and I'd recommend that all of you read it if you can. Read it because it's so astonishing. Astonishing because it's a national security document, so you'd expect that it would be about national security. Almost all of it is about economics. Almost all of it is about how to structure the planet economically. And in that national security document, the United States says unabashedly that it can and will lead the world. That it's never a question of whether the United States will lead. That the United States is the world's indispensable power. That it has primacy. That it has a leadership role. That sounds nice when you put it that way. It has a leadership role. It has primacy. The Italian philosopher Domenico Lussardo describes this another way. It says the United States pursues, or there is an international dictatorship of the United States, which is another way of talking about primacy and leading the world. The second chapter of this book is titled Regime Change, and it is an examination of two forces which have worked to bring about regime change in Damascus since the middle 1950s. They've worked sometimes separately, sometimes together. The first force is the United States government under the sway of the U.S. business-owning class. And the second force is the Muslim Brotherhood, the ideological antecedent of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. I should hasten to add that it's also the ideological antecedent of more moderate groups, Islamic groups. In Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood is committed to violence as a means of bringing about political change. The Muslim Brotherhood in some other countries is not committed to violence. It's committed to participating in elections. Why the difference? Well, the Muslim Brotherhood's committed to violence in Syria. One of the reasons why is because the Syrian constitution bans political parties based on religion. That means that the Muslim Brotherhood has little recourse but to seek political change through extra-constitutional means and through violence. However, I'll talk later about why it is that there is a prohibition in Syria against political parties based on religion. The Muslim Brotherhood in Syria has worked since the early 1960s to topple the government in Damascus in order to replace it with a Sunni Islamic state. Both the U.S. government and the Muslim Brothers have worked together on efforts of regime change. Chapter 3 is titled The 2011 Distemper. This is a look at whether the uprising, which broke out in 2011, mid-March 2011, whether it was a secular democratic revolt against dictatorship and neoliberalism, as some people argue, and I'll discuss that in more detail in a few moments. Chapter 4 is titled The Myth of the Moderate Rebel, and it is an examination of who the insurgents are, the insurgents that the U.S. government labels as moderates, and what their relationship is to the non-moderate rebels, especially Al-Qaeda. Moderate rebels were defined. The interesting thing about the phrase moderate is that moderate is used to connote rather than denote. It's used to suggest something. Moderation is something good. This was a deliberately constructed phrase of deception. And we know that because if you ever read press reports about the moderate rebels, it might have occurred to you to ask what is meant by moderate anyway? I know what they want me to think. Moderate, that sounds like pacific, inclined to discussion, perhaps pluralistic. Well, what was really meant was finally revealed by then head of U.S. intelligence, James Clapper, who was talking to the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council on Foreign Relations is kind of a lobby group on behalf of Wall Street. And he said, well, moderate rebels, the moderate rebels are any rebels other than ISIS. That's the definition of moderate. Anyone other than ISIS, irrespective of their orientation toward democracy, irrespective of the methods they use, irrespective of their goals or their ideology. They're simply called moderate simply because they were not ISIS. The moderate rebels, in fact, in the main, are Islamists whose goal is not democracy, but a Sunni Islamic state. They are, in the main, insurgents who use terrorist methods. Not exclusively. They also use other methods of guerrilla warfare, but they also use terrorist methods. And they cooperate on the battlefield with Al-Qaeda. They are enmeshed with Al-Qaeda. They work under license to Al-Qaeda. They are auxiliaries of Al-Qaeda. And they pass their U.S.-supplied weapons to Al-Qaeda. It's fascinating. You don't see it much anymore, but the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Washington Post would talk about U.S.-trained rebels, and they used all kinds of phrases to describe the relationship of those rebels to Al-Qaeda. They said they were enmeshed with them, they were entangled with them, they were cooperating on the battlefield with them, they were sharing weapons with them. Essentially, they were Al-Qaeda, but they're Al-Qaeda under another name. The name was U.S. Supplied and Trained Moderate Rebels. Chapter 5 is titled The Ba'athist Islamic Ally. Ba'athists are the Arab nationalists. The Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party, and I emphasize socialist because that's part of the explanation for why Free Enterprise Washington is opposed to the Ba'ath Arab Socialists. And there may be some who are raising their eyes and saying, yeah, they might call themselves socialists, but are they really socialists? So, I mean, what is socialism? You can define it in many ways. But the significant question is, does the United States regard them as socialists? And is that one of the reasons why the U.S. government is hostile to the Ba'ath Arab Socialist government of Damascus? And I believe very much it is. And there's no question that the United States regards the government in Damascus as a socialist government. You can read U.S. State Department documents in which complaints are made about the socialist orientation of the government in Damascus. Well, I'll come back to that in a second. The Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party is the party to which Bashar al-Assad belongs. It's also the party to which Saddam of Iraq belonged. The party has three major goals. Unity of the Arab world, so overcoming its religious and other differences, including laying to rest the antagonism between Sunni and Shia. Freedom from foreign domination, that's its second goal. And socialism. Socialism defined as public ownership of the commanding heights of the economy and a significant role for government in the guidance of the economy. The Arab nationalist values of unity, freedom, and socialism also inspired Muammar Gaddafi and were explicitly referred to in the constitution, the first constitution that Gaddafi had written. Gaddafi was greatly impressed by the great Arab nationalist leader, the Egyptian Gamal Abdel Nasser, whose lieutenant he aspired to become. And if you read his constitution, Gaddafi's constitution, which he originally wrote, you'll see explicit references to unity, freedom, socialism. If you read the Syrian constitutions, the one that was written in 2012, the one written by Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father, in 1973, you'll see references to unity, freedom, socialism. If you read the constitution that was prepared for Iraq by Saddam, you'll also see references to unity, freedom, socialism. These values are also implicitly present in the constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And it is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the Ba'athist Islamic ally referred to in the chapter title. Now, the political Islam of Iran is non-sectarian. It seeks the unity of the Muslim world and the bridging of differences between Shia and Sunni. It also seeks the freedom of the Muslim world from foreign domination. And it favors an economic model which is largely indistinguishable from the economic model favored by Arab nationalists, namely a model of economic planning and public ownership of the commanding heights of the economy. So many people wonder, you know, why are Iran and Syria allies? Well, they're allies because they want the same things for the most part. But they say, Syria is secular. Iran is Islamic. How is it that they could be allies? Especially since secular Syria is entangled in a war with Islamists. Well, the Iranians want to overcome sectarian differences in the Muslim world. The Arab nationalists want to overcome sectarian differences in the Arab part of the Muslim world. The Iranians want to liberate the Muslim world from foreign domination. The Arab nationalists want to liberate the Arab part of the Muslim world from foreign domination. The Iranians favor a significant role for the state in the economy, and the Arab nationalists favor a significant role for the state in the economy. Those are significant reasons why Iran and Syria are allies, despite the fact that one government is secular and the other government is Islamist. Chapter 6 is titled Washington State Islamic Allies, as opposed to its non-state Islamic allies, like Al-Qaeda, for example, or the so-called moderate rebels, most of whom are Islamists. And this is a look at the Islamic countries that are allies of the United States. So if the Islamic State of Iran is an ally of Arab nationalist Syria because they share a commitment to unity and a commitment to freedom from foreign domination and a commitment to socialism, then you might expect that the Islamic allies of Washington would share a commitment to disunity in the Arab and Muslim worlds, a commitment to U.S. hegemony over the Arab and Muslim worlds, and a commitment to free enterprise. And indeed, that would be the case. Washington's principal Islamic State ally, Saudi Arabia, promotes a very divisive brand of Islam, which operates against the efforts of Arab nationalists and the Islamic Republic of Iran to overcome the sectarian differences which divide the Arab and Muslim worlds. The Saudi monarchy is also highly integrated into the U.S. financial elite and depends on the United States for protection against the Saudi population, which is hostile to the monarchy. Chapter 7 is called Divide et Impera, or Latin for divide and rule. I'm not sure why I said Divide et Impera. Maybe I felt Latin that day. And Chapter 8, Echoes of Hitler, look at the efforts of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Muslim Brothers' ally, Washington, and Washington's ally, Saudi Arabia, to divide the Arab world on religious grounds. Chapter 7 looks at how the United States restructured Iraq's political system in order to bring sectarian cleavages to the fore. In this time-honored imperialist, you know, tradition of divide and rule, Chapter 8 looks at efforts to paint Arab nationalists in Damascus who seek to bridge the Arab world's religious and other differences, but seek to describe them as an Alawi regime, using Arab nationalism as a cover to pursue a sectarian agenda. We don't see that much anymore, but say in 2016, 2015, there was a lot of writing in the press which would suggest that, as they called it, the Assad regime was an Alawi regime, which was attempting to pursue some kind of sectarian agenda in Syria. There's been this conflation of the Alawi sect with Arab nationalism. It certainly comes from the Muslim Brotherhood to suggest that secular Arab nationalism is simply a cover for the Alawis to pursue their sectarian agenda. Chapter 9 is titled Wall Street's Empire, and it answers the question Chomsky posed as essential to understanding U.S. foreign policy. Who sets U.S. foreign policy? What interests do these people represent? What is the domestic source of their power? So let me just step you through an historical timeline of the conflict in Syria. So this will be a look at the long war. In the mid-1950s, Washington conspired with London to purge Arab nationalist influence from Syria. Their target was a triumvirate of Arab nationalist and communist leaders who Washington and London perceived as threatening economic interests in the Middle East. Spearheading the effort was Kermit Roosevelt of the infamous Roosevelt family, which gave us two U.S. presidents. Kermit himself was infamous. You may know him as the man who engineered the overthrow of Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who committed the grave crime against Western domination of nationalizing Iran's oil industry. Roosevelt and British intelligence, MI6, planned to enlist the help of the Muslim Brothers to overthrow the three men in Damascus they saw as threatening Western economic interests. In the 1960s, the Muslim Brothers led protests, strikes, demonstrations, riots in Syria under the banner Islam or Ba'ath, by which they meant Islam or secularism, always in opposition to what the brothers called the government's godless character. In 1967, the Brotherhood declared a holy war against secular nationalists, denouncing them as infidels and enemies of God. In the 1970s, the Brotherhood established an underground paramilitary organization anticipating the so-called rebels of today. The 1970s rebels were armed and trained outside of Syria, just as today's rebels are armed and trained outside of Syria by U.S. and Western intelligence services in Qatar and Jordan. The brothers launched a major campaign of urban guerrilla warfare, assassinating Ba'ath Arab socialists, murdering state officials, killing army officers, attacking Syrian government buildings, assaulting Syrian military installations. In 1973, Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father, oversaw the drafting of a constitution for Syria that promulgated a mission for his country. And the mission would be to foster the unity of the Arab world, to overcome its religious, sectarian, other differences, in order to achieve the Arab world's liberation from foreign domination and to modernize and indigenize the economy. Modernization and indigenization of the economy would be planned. This is written into the Constitution by economic planning and public ownership, what Washington would denounce as socialism. Indeed, in Washington, Assad was denounced as an Arab communist. He wasn't a communist. In fact, he was suspicious of communists, and communists were suspicious of him. But from Washington's perspective, he may as well have been a communist because the policies he implemented had effects on corporate America equal to the effects of policies that communists would have implemented. In the 1980s, Robert Baer, a CIA officer who served in the Middle East for three decades, found that Syria was, quote, the epicenter of Islamic terrorism. Baer wrote, "When I first set foot in Damascus in 1980, I estimated that Assad had maybe 3 or 4 years before he went under. The Muslim Brothers owned the street. The mosque schools were teaching jihad. The mosque public address system blared out a message of hate and revenge. I figured this guy's going to get strung up on a light pole in downtown Damascus along with a whole lot of other Syrians." In the 1980s, the Brothers established an Islamic Front for Syria, whose manifesto declared a war without end until Ba'ath Arab socialism was exterminated in Syria. In 1982, the Muslim Brothers seized control of Hama, Syria's fourth largest city. They went on a blood-soaked rampage. They attacked police stations. They murdered any Ba'ath Arab socialist they could find. They executed government officials. They killed soldiers. Every Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party official in the city was executed, many by decapitation. In the Syrian government operation to quell the uprising, the Syrian Arab Army captured more than 15,000 foreign-supplied machine guns, along with prisoners, including Jordanian and CIA-trained paramilitaries. Likewise, insurgents operating in Syria today have been trained by the CIA and other Western intelligence services in Qatar and Jordan, as I mentioned. In the 1990s, the Muslim Brotherhood established an alliance with other sectarian or Sunni sectarian Sunni political Islamists to form what became known as the National Front for the Salvation of Syria, but perhaps was more aptly called the National Front for the Salvation of Syria from secularism. The front had two goals. Its most pressing and immediate goal was the assassination of Assad. Its longer fundamental goal was to establish an Islamic state in Syria based on the Quran.
You've just been listening to a recent speech given by Canadian foreign policy analyst and author Stephen Gowans, speaking about his new book called Washington's Long War on Syria. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of that informative speech. Stephen Gowans has a website called What's Left, and you can get to it by going to www.gowans.wordpress.com. So gowans.wordpress.com, and Gowans is spelled G-O-W-A-N-S. So gowans.wordpress.com. And now for the events and David Ray Griffin's new book. The first event is the 2017 Hiroshima Nagasaki Remembrance, A Call to Abolish Nuclear War event, which is going on Sunday, August 6th, at the Unitarian Society of Hartford from 6 to 9 p.m. It's at 50 Bloomfield Avenue in Hartford. And at 6 p.m. is a potluck, and at 6:30 the program begins with music, speakers, poetry, and a beautiful candlelighting ceremony. I highly recommend this event. I've been in the past, and it's a very moving, well-done program. To find out more information, you can go to the website www.hopeoutloud.org. And again, that's www.hopeoutloud.org. And the second event will be on Saturday, August 12th, at the Juicy J Juice Bar in Hartford. It's at 494A Farmington Avenue. The Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group will be showing the first part of the film Incontrovertible at the Juicy J's Juice Bar at 7 p.m. And again, that's Saturday, August 12th. So come and join us for some healthy food and drink from the Juicy J Juice Bar and see this incredible film that presents the evidence that explodes the official story of 9/11. And again, that's Saturday, August 12th at the Juicy J Juice Bar, 494A Farmington Avenue in Hartford at 7 p.m. And now for the new book by Dr. David Ray Griffin. As many of you know, Dr. David Ray Griffin has written 11 books on 9/11, challenging the official story. And his latest book has just come out. It's called How Bush and Cheney Ruined America and the World. And the first two-thirds of the book are about Bush and Cheney in the aftermath of 9/11. And the last third of the book is about the miracles of 9/11. So again, this book has just been released, and it's called How Bush and Cheney Ruined America and the World. And also stay tuned, because David Ray Griffin will be joining me on the show in a few weeks to discuss this new book. And just as a reminder, 9/11 Wake Up Call shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. And once on the site, click on Contributors and then look for and click on Cheryl under the letter C, and the shows should pop up. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Puerto Rico, trapped between colonialism, and hurricanes. By way of introduction of Nelson Dennis, a former New York State Assemblyman who is the author of The War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony, who joins us now as we examine Puerto Rico between a rock and a hard place, between colonialism and hurricanes. And Nelson, you wrote a wonderful piece that was published in the New York Times, and I want to get straight into it. So amidst President Trump's visit Puerto Rico, there is a humanitarian crisis, but there has been a crisis that preceded the hurricane. Talk to us about that and talk to us about your thoughts and your concerns about what can be done. And I know it's relevant to the Jones Act, and our listeners are going to find out a lot more about that. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Mimi. And you always pick a really critical time. And right now, as you said, it is a rock and a hard place. And there's a historical context that I think would be useful for people to recall. The United States went in 1898, pursuant to the Spanish-American War in Puerto Rico. The very next year, in 1899, was a hurricane even larger than Hurricane Maria. It was called Hurricane San Ciriaco, the most devastating hurricane of the 19th century, of the entire century. And it leveled the island, and the United States' response was in the following year, which would then be the year 1900, they devalued the Puerto Rican currency by 40%. So that was a sort of a Niobe Klein shock doctrine response rather than hurricane relief. And there's a real concern now that there's something comparable afoot. We have a PROMESA legislation, a financial control board that is basically a credit collection agency for hedge funds, and the Jones Act. And between the two of those and this hurricane, Puerto Rico is completely against the ropes. So this is a time for people to be aware that something really, a tectonic shift has to occur in Puerto Rico right now to avoid a complete humanitarian crisis.
The crony capitalism of the Jones Act does not protect anyone, and it is choking the economy of Puerto Rico. We said we were going to tell our listeners more about the Jones Act, which you featured in your piece in the New York Times. Do that for us and talk about how critical it is to respond to the Jones Act at this particular point in time.
That act has a unique and really historic evolution. It was promulgated in 1920. It's the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. And the historic element is that it was a response to a fear of German U-2 boats, which had sunk over 5,000 ships in the Atlantic during World War I. And so the Jones Act was a protective measure to protect that Atlantic naval routes, the mercantile routes, the U.S. coastline, and ships. And in its application, it mandates that only U.S. boats can be chartered from one U.S. port to another. That only U.S. boats are allowed to do that, not foreign registry vessels. And that in Puerto Rico, the application of this is twofold. Any foreign registry vessel that does come into Puerto Rico is only allowed to do so under the tenets of the Jones Act with a set of taxes, fees, duties, all sorts of costs that are then passed on to the Puerto Rican consumer. That's if the foreign registry vessel goes directly to Puerto Rico. The only option to that under the Jones Act is that it reroutes that vessel can go to Jacksonville, Florida, where all the goods are offloaded, the original boat, then reloaded onto a U.S. boat, and then that boat reroutes into Puerto Rico. It's the equivalent of digging a ditch to fill it up again. And yet again, the costs of that are passed on to the Puerto Rican consumer, which amounts to about close to 20% for anything that's on that ship. And yeah, Puerto Rico, which is an island, it's a small island, needs to import virtually everything, including, this is really key, oil. It has to import its oil, and the electrical grid in Puerto Rico runs entirely on oil. So all its electricity is dependent on the on this foreign import, but it's coming under the auspices of the Jones Act, so it's overpriced. Right now here in New York, we pay about 9 cents per kilowatt hour, and Puerto Ricans pay about 25, nearly triple the electricity rate that we do. That's just as an example. And the major component in that is the Jones Act. So it affects everything. It affects food, everything that is critical right now in Puerto Rico, food, water, medicine, building materials, the oil for the electricity, all of that is coming in under the Jones Act. And it's been strangling Puerto Rico since 1920. There's no more U-2 boats. There's none lurking off the coast of Puerto Rico. But we do have a Jones Act, which is a greater security threat than any other perceived foreign threat in the world. So that is what Puerto Rico is facing, this tremendous price gouging, which allows U.S. corporations to just charge their goods at a slightly lower rate than the foreign registry vessel goods. And thereby it turns Puerto Rico into a captive market. It's an international price rigging scheme. And it's for that reason that the United States, that Puerto Rico is the fifth largest market for U.S. products. Fifth largest market in the world. There's more Walgreens and Walmarts per square mile in Puerto Rico than anywhere else on the planet. Mm. And it's all under the hyperinflated protection of the Jones Act. And so this is a time, if there's any real meaningful, any substantial concern to the people of Puerto Rico, the one clearest way for the United States to evince that concern is to suspend the Jones Act in Puerto Rico.
You're actually saying then that you don't believe that there would be a public for Puerto Rico if the Jones Act did not exist. Well, is that saying too much?
So the numbers there, the numbers are really clear. The Jones Act, various studies, not me, studies have been conducted, and it's anywhere from the estimates have been anywhere from $3 to $6 billion a year. Some are higher, but if you do the simple math, even at the lower rate of $3 billion a year, 3 times 98, because the Jones Act has been in existence since 1920, 3 times 98 is just shy of $300 billion. I think that would be $294 billion. So therefore, the public debt of Puerto Rico would have been paid 4 times over by if they hadn't the Jones Act didn't exist. Pretty clear. I mean, the numbers are there.
Mm.
So that's when I always put quotation marks around this debt, because this debt was essentially created by the plenary jurisdiction of the U.S. Congress. But now we're facing a supposed debt, a financial control board, a Jones Act, and a hurricane all together, all at once.
Hmm. Continue to tie in for us, like suspending or repealing the law, you indicate, is crucial to the arduous rebuilding process ahead. I know, I remember in one town alone, 70,000 people were evacuated because of a failing dam. How would the Jones Act relief enable residents, for example, to buy materials or rebuild? Make that connection for us.
It's a simple one. Straightforward. All you just see is the all-inclusiveness of the Jones Act. It applies to everything. And Puerto Rico has to import virtually everything. Back when the United States came in, agriculture was about 70 to 80% of the Puerto Rico gross national product and their economy. Agriculture was over 70%. It is now less than 1%. So literally, Puerto Rico isn't feeding itself. It imports food. It imports food, water, the oil for the electricity, medicine. Every aspect. It's like you're a fish swimming in an ocean. Puerto Rico is in that ocean. Everywhere, everything that is purchased and consumed in Puerto Rico is penetrated by the Jones Act. So it affects every aspect of just everyday life, and the per capita income in Puerto Rico is roughly $17,000 a year, less than half that of Mississippi, the poorest state in the United States. So Puerto Ricans are extremely price sensitive. Anything that can save them a few pennies is critical. And it's for that reason the United States, the U.S. corporations have been benefiting enormously. The same car in U.S. made automobile costs $6,000 more in San Juan than it does in Miami. Food across the board costs twice as much in Puerto Rico than it does in the U.S. mainland. The same food, the same breadbasket of food. All of these things are coming in under the auspices of the Jones Act. So to suspend the Jones Act would be single-handed to eliminate this international price rigging scenario. And in the longer run, it would allow Puerto Ricans to develop their own inherent shipping economy, their own admiralty, be able to negotiate their own internal pricing structure. It is a foundational way to allow Puerto Ricans once and for all, to develop their own private economy. It's for that reason that the public sector of Puerto Rico is so explosive, and you have 78 mayoralties and so many bloated government bureaucracy and the large payrolls that help to create this public debt, because there's no private sector. There's no private economy. Well, lifting the Jones off the neck of Puerto Rico would allow that a private economy to develop. So in the short run, in terms of emergency hurricane relief, getting food, water, medicine, electricity up. There's an island-wide blackout still in Puerto Rico, which is projected to last for several months. And it's for that reason that most people have been able to speak with their family members. All of those things would immediately be affected. There'd be more access to all of that. And then you would have the jumpstart of the Puerto Rican economy. And all of this would flow from relieving it from Jones Act relief.
Nelson Dennis, the island, which you point out, is the fifth largest market in the world for American products. There are more Walmarts and Walgreens per square mile in Puerto Rico than anywhere else on the planet. And at the same time, you know, you wind up with, you've pointed out in your article, there are three American territories that are exempt from the Jones Act, including the United States Virgin Island. How did this come about, and how do we now respond, and where does the pressure get put to begin to eliminate this stranglehold, this shakedown, as somebody described it, this kind of mafia protection racket with Puerto Rico as a captive market?
Well, the way it developed is that Puerto Rico was always a profit center. First, it was a naval coaling station back in 1898, but then very quickly, they became aware that the agriculture, the soil, the climate was perfect in Puerto Rico to turn it into a one crop cash cow economy that of sugar, and accordingly, the United States managed to become the owner of roughly 80% of Puerto Rico's arable land within the first 30 years, by 1930, and after that. Then progressed into becoming a tax haven for U.S. corporations, and most notably until recently, the pharmaceutical company. And they would provide employment in Puerto Rico, but under completely tax-protected circumstances, and none of those corporations would engage in any infrastructure investment or pay any particular taxes to Puerto Rico. So when the 20-year tax exemptions would expire, they would all just leave the island and create a constant cycle of unemployment and unemployment, boom and bust, complete dependence on U.S. corporations, but always profitable for U.S. corporations. From that, now it's evolved into a triple tax-exempt municipal bond haven, and Puerto Rico is the only jurisdiction that's been able to issue those, and that's one reason why statehood, I feel, is not anywhere on the horizon very soon. So it's always been a relationship where the United States is benefiting economically in a huge, in some ways undisclosed ways, because the U.S. taxpayers aren't very often, they don't concern, they have a lot of things to worry about. They don't know about the Jones Act, or about the triple tax exempt bonds, or they don't think about it, they think it through. But this is all part of a larger fabric of a highly one-sided economic relationship. And that's what's evolved in Puerto Rico. And there's been a lack of advocacy because Puerto Rico is essentially a small island, 1,500 miles, separated by 1,500 miles of ocean from Washington, D.C. and from New York. And so its presence is not felt. It does not have a congressional representative. And now with Citizens United, the loudest voices in Puerto Rico, in Washington, are the ones that carry a checkbook. So the response would need to be a high degree of awareness and pressure, especially on the the House Committee on Natural Resources, which is chaired by Jim Young, they're the ones that wrote the PROMESA legislation and created the Financial Control Board. And they're the ones that tabled an amendment from Congressman Gary Palmer, who sought to add Jones Act relief, to structure that into the PROMESA legislation. He proposed an amendment that would make that a part of the Financial Control Board and the PROMESA bill that, yeah, we're going to do all that, but we're also going to enable Puerto Ricans to have an economy so that they can pay these debts and so that they won't incur them in the future. Well, Congressman Jim Young tabled that immediately as non-germane to the bill, which basically demonstrated very clearly what the purpose of the bill was, which is to be just a credit collection agency for hedge funds. Well, there has to be a concerted effort to change that philosophy and to have the essential self-sustaining economic activity in Puerto Rico be a part of how Washington views Puerto Rico, or if not, Puerto Rico will never get off the mat. It'll never get back on its feet.
And I would like to ask you a kind of final question just to clarify, and then we're going to continue to pick up the discussion about the rebuilding of Puerto Rico with David Galarza. But it's not just clearly about recovering from Hurricane Maria. It is also about Puerto Rico's long-term future. If the Jones Act were suspended, what would happen to consumer prices? What would happen to the modernization of the infrastructure? What would happen to the rebuilding of Puerto Rico?
Well, you've actually just answered it. The price gouging would end. It would be immediate. Virtually everything consumed in Puerto Rico would now cost 15% to 20% less. So you've capsulized that in the question that you asked. The infrastructure would be potentially in a position to be modernized rather than to just be public-private partnerships, which is where this Jones Act scenario is leading. Where it's leading is that any redevelopment and rebuilding efforts will be utterly dependent on U.S. capital, which will then attach public-private partnership component to all of that, and basically as a way of wedging U.S. ownership over the entire public the public infrastructure of Puerto Rico, the ports, the highways, airports, schools, bridges, anything that's government-owned is now fair game as a quote-unquote P3, a public-private partnership, but it's really P5. Public-private partnerships for the plunder of Puerto Rico. Mm. That's where we're headed if we don't have some progressive legislation and outlook, such as revising or suspending the Jones Act. All of these things will flow from suspending the Jones Act. Immediate hurricane relief and the opportunity to rebuild the Puerto Rican infrastructure. And what the United States does over the next month or two will very clearly demonstrate what is in the hearts of the U.S. power structure with respect to Puerto Rico.
Well, Nelson Dennis, thank you for spending some time with us. Nelson Dennis, former New York State Assemblyman, is the author of, and you must, it's a must-read book, War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony. And we want to have you back very soon to continue to talk about this critical issue for Puerto Rico, which really is caught between the rock and the hard place, which we denote as between colonialism and the hurricanes. Thanks a lot for being with us.
I appreciate the time, Amy. We'll talk again.
And we are now joined by David Galarza, a long-term labor and nationalist activist around Puerto Rico. And I wonder if you have any particular thoughts relevant to what Nelson Dennis has been talking about elimination of suspension of the Jones Act. And then I know that you were particularly concerned about some of the environmental issues that really precipitated the severity of the damage that was done by Hurricane Irma and Maria. And thanks for joining us, David.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Mimi. And it's always a pleasure to hear and be following Nelson Dennis, who I consider such an important member of our community, and whose book, like you mentioned, War Against All Puerto Ricans, is a critical read now more than ever, just because of all the dynamics and all the things that are coming to pass that he's always talked about and always written about and always spoken about throughout Puerto Rico and throughout the U.S. And so, yeah, definitely in terms of the Jones Act, that would help the elimination of the Jones Act, specifically those cabotage laws that are so outdated, would definitely be a boon to Puerto Rico. We fully support that call to end the cabotage laws, specifically those cabotage laws, because they're just so outdated. Additionally to that, you know, Nelson talked about the debt. On Monday, the hedge clippers, you know, joined with New York Communities for Change, Senator Gustavo Rivera, Hector Figueroa, the president of Local 32BJ of the SEIU, and many other activists, the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement, we made a call on the steps of City Hall to also suspend or cancel the debt in Puerto Rico, specifically the debt dealing with the agency, the electric company, the public entity there that owes billions and billions of dollars to these bondholders. And right now is not a time to try to squeeze money out of Puerto Rico. Like I said during the press conference, you can't get blood from a stone. For us, Puerto Rico is our rock, our stone, and the people in Puerto Rico are our blood. And we cannot squeeze a single penny, a single cent from Puerto Rico right now, because everything needs to be committed to the rebuilding process in Puerto Rico. So that's of utmost importance, and I would urge everybody, everybody, not just Puerto Ricanos, but everybody, to keep that issue on the limelight and to make that call to their elected officials, because Oppenheimer Group and the Blue Mountain Capital and all these hedge fund vultures that created that first storm, which is the austerity storm, which is the Promesa and the Junta that now governs the financial conditions in Puerto Rico, and basically calls the shots on just about everything there, because it's colonial government to begin with, and now this junta, unelected, unaccountable to anybody, is calling the shots financially, and they think they're being generous by freeing up $1 billion to this effort, and that's not enough. You know, that's going to be a drop in the bucket. Puerto Rico's going to need billions and billions and billions of dollars to rebuild, and that debt was already illegal and questionable to begin with, which is why they never allowed it a bona fide audit, independent audit of that debt. So that's what we're calling for, a moratorium, short of a moratorium, an absolute cancellation of that debt. Mimi, you talked about the environmental aspect in Puerto Rico, and I'm sorry for going on. You tell me, you know,
no, not at all, not at all.
Please interrupt me at any point. But in terms of the environment, right now in Puerto Rico, it's not only, you know, being hit with Maria was hard enough, but we have at the very least some 23 Superfund sites, toxic sites all over the island. We have like 27 landfills all over Puerto Rico that are out of compliance. We had the situation where you've reported in the past, and people continue to protest against the dumping of toxic ashes in the town of Peñuelas and in Humacao and other places in Puerto Rico. These are ashes that are generated by a dirty coal-burning facility in the southern part of Puerto Rico to produce electricity. And there was a five-story pile of ashes prior to Maria. That company that's based in Arlington, Virginia, AES, was told to cover it, and of course they didn't. So we can only surmise that all those ashes were spread all over Puerto Rico. So the air, the land, the water in Puerto Rico is absolutely polluted. So it's an environmental disaster of epic proportions right now, which is what, you know, which is interesting at a time such as this, a critical time. The EPA pulled out because for them supposedly it was too dangerous for their personnel. At a time when Puerto Ricanos need to have that air, land, and water tested, the agency that's responsible for keeping people, a U.S. citizens in Puerto Rico, which is what they are, safe, is not doing its job, which is, you know, dereliction of duty, which is absolutely abominable and shameful that people are left to their own devices like that. So that's something that needs to be highlighted and something that, you know, folks also need to be very mindful of, especially during the aid process, the rebuilding process. In today's paper in Puerto Rico, in El Nuevo Día, Casa Pueblo, Arturo Masol, who's a spokesman for Casa Pueblo, which is an organization that I absolutely adore because of what they're doing in Puerto Rico, made a call to the diaspora and to anybody else who wants to help to Puerto Rico, that if they're going to donate goods, especially goods to help light homes, to donate solar-powered bulbs and solar-powered flashlights and that sort of thing. We don't need to have more batteries in landfills, and we don't need more disposable things that will end up in these landfills. And we have to start
We have about 30 seconds, David, so perhaps you can give us the information about the organization so people can get in touch with them and make their contributions through that important organization. And, of course, we're going to begin continuing this discussion in the weeks and days to come. We know we want to suspend the Jones Act. We should eliminate the debt from PROMESA. Indeed, we should get rid of the junta. And where can people make the contributions?
Well, to this one specifically, this organization is at casapueblo.org, which is CASAPUEBLO.org. Again, CASAPUEBLO.org. And there are many other frontline organizations that deserve our support, that deserve our donations. I would urge people not to give to the big, you know, disaster industrial complex. That money gets murky, and we never know what really gets to our people. So please do the research and donate to local community-based organizations that are already on the front line, like them and Comedores Sociales and Caño Martín Peña. There's some dynamic organizations doing that work, and they have been doing the work for years.
And we're going to have to leave it there.
Okay. Thank you.
And I want to thank you so much for the work that you always do and continue to keep us posted on this horrific humanitarian crisis. And we say that Puerto Rico really is between the hard rock of colonialism and the hurricane, and we have to address both. We've been speaking with David Galarza, who we will continue to have join us in the weeks and months to come. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson claimed to have written a letter to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov raising the issue of violence in Chechnya, but the State Department has declined to release copies of the letter.
My friend spoke with somebody who said, look, I've got a newborn, I don't have time to speak right now, but just in case they're gay, I'm voting yes.
I don't want him on the show.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A crackdown on queers begins in Azerbaijan, a gay youth comments on the genocide in Chechnya, and Aussie activists doorknock and phone bank for equality. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 23rd, 2017. Echoes of the Chechen genocide reverberated in Azerbaijan this week, with reports that more than 100 gay and transgender people have been arrested and tortured following raids in the capital of Baku. Detainees have been threatened or beaten until they provide authorities with the names and addresses of their friends. Some transgender detainees reportedly have had their heads shaven. According to Eurasianet.com, police officials claimed that the raids were a crackdown on prostitution and had nothing to do with detainees' sexual orientation. But a statement issued by Ayaz Efendiev, deputy chairman of the Minority Justice Party, seemed to contradict that claim. Defending these creatures who are sources of immorality, dangerous diseases, and who have been cursed by God, he said, Western circles are trying to destroy our national traditions under the name of human rights. Homosexuality has been legal in Azerbaijan since 2000, but LGBT people in the nation at the crossroads of southeastern Europe and southwest Asia still face routine and systematic oppression. The European Parliament formally condemned the intimidation and repression of sexual minorities in the country in 2015. The following year, the global queer rights group ILGA ranked Azerbaijan the worst place in Europe to live for LGBT people. Javid Nabiyev, president of the LGBT Azerbaijan Alliance, told Pink News that it's unclear what prompted the roundup or how many people have been affected. He said that defense lawyers say at least 100 people have been detained over the course of several days. Nabiyev said the raids have taken place in private homes, workplaces, and public spaces where gay people are known to congregate. We are using all tools and resources to inform all LGBT people to be careful, to not have new dates, and to stay in the shadows for a while, he said. Everybody has a fear that they might be arrested at any time.
Authorities in the East African nation of Tanzania have also been cracking down on LGBT people in recent months. Police raided an HIV/AIDS education workshop on September 16th, being held at a hotel on the semi-autonomous island of Zanzibar. Regional Police Commander Hassan Ali Nasri told state television that the 12 women and 8 men who were taken into custody are implicated in homosexuality. We arrested them and are busy interrogating them. The police cannot turn a blind eye to this practice. Tanzania banned private health centers from providing HIV/AIDS-related care in February because doing so promotes homosexual activities, according to the country's health minister. The government subsequently banned the use of lube because it encouraged men to have sex with each other, and promised that anyone advocating for LGBT rights would be arrested. Authorities have also warned that LGBT foreigners in the country would be deported. President John Magufuli has infamously blamed Westerners who brought us drugs and homosexual practices that even cows disapprove of. Homosexual activity is a crime in Tanzania, punishable by up to 30 years in prison. A travel alert issued by International SOS has advised LGBT travelers to maintain a low profile at all times in the country because they may be harassed or arrested because of their sexual orientation or non-conforming gender presentation.
A judge in Brazil challenged the country's reputation as one of the most queer-friendly countries in Latin America this week by overturning a 1999 ban on so-called conversion therapy that purports to make gay people straight. Judge Waldemar de Carvalho ruled in Brasilia that evangelical Christian plaintiff Rosangela Justino, whose psychology license was revoked last year for offering to cure a patient's homosexuality, has the right to practice the heavily debunked therapy. Justino once told a local newspaper that, "I feel directed by God to help people who are homosexual." But virtually every reputable professional mental health organization in the Western world has declared the practice useless at best and often psychologically damaging to the patient. Ivete Sangalo, one of Brazil's most popular singers, was among several entertainers to criticize the ruling, saying that the sick ones are those who believe in this grand absurdity. Rio de Janeiro councillor Rogério Giannini joined the chorus of condemnation, noting that there is no way to cure what is not a disease. Thousands of rainbow flag-waving demonstrators gathered in downtown Sao Paulo to protest the ruling on September 22nd, as songs like Lady Gaga's Born This Way energized chants of "It's not a disease." The Federal Council of Psychology lambasted the ruling and promised to appeal the decision. Activists are also thinking about taking the case to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights.
In better news for the global queer community and their friends, Serbia's out premier, Ana Brnabic, became the first leader of a Balkan nation to march in a queer pride parade when she joined several hundred LGBTQ people and their allies amid tight security in Belgrade on September 17th. Several previous marches have ended violently as right-wing extremists attacked participants and the police officers trying to protect them. Generally peaceful pride parades have been held since 2014, but riot police cordoned off the city center with metal fences this year to prevent any repeats of the violent past. Brnabic told reporters that the Serbian government will respect the rights of all the citizens. We want to send a signal that diversity makes our society stronger, she added, that together we can do more. Brnabic attended the Pride March last year when she was public administration minister in the previous government of now President Aleksandar Vučić, who had declined previous invitations to attend the festivities. The former ultranationalist, who now identifies as a pro-European Union reformer, chose Brnabic to succeed him as premier earlier this year after he was elected president. Critics accused him of pinkwashing in an effort to improve Serbia's chances of winning membership in the EU.
Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union is suing the state of Michigan in federal court for allowing state-funded private adoption and fostering agencies to refuse applications from same-gender couples. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services allows faith-based agencies to reject those couples based on religious belief. Republican Governor Rick Snyder signed the bill permitting that bias in 2015. The ACLU is charging that the law violates the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment, which forbids the use of religious criteria in the provision of government services. It also says the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause is being violated because the law discriminates against same-gender couples. The ACLU characterizes the need for adoptive families across the U.S. as desperate and points to studies that show same-gender couples to be 4 times more likely to adopt and 6 times more likely to foster children. Faith-based organizations, the group says, are preventing children from having stable homes based on criteria that have nothing to do with their ability to care for a child. Alabama, North Dakota, South Dakota, Mississippi, Texas, and Virginia have similar laws that allow child placement agencies to reject prospective gay and lesbian parents based on religious belief.
And finally, Queer Women and Queer Storylines won big at the 69th Annual Emmy Awards on September 17th in Los Angeles. The Handmaid's Tale, the dark feminist drama that includes several lesbian characters, took home Emmys for Outstanding Drama Series, Outstanding Lead Actress Elizabeth Moss, and Outstanding Director Reed Morano. Saturday Night Live's powerhouse lesbian star Kate McKinnon won the trophy for Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series for the 2nd year in a row. The sci-fi lesbian love story San Junipero from the series Black Mirror was awarded Outstanding TV Movie and Outstanding Writing for a Limited Series, Movie, or Dramatic Special. but the lesbian star of the night had to be Lena Waithe. She shared the Emmy with Master of None star Aziz Ansari for outstanding writing for a comedy series for the Thanksgiving episode. She became the first African-American woman to win the award and was celebrated with a standing ovation. She gave an exuberant shout-out to her peeps at the end of her acceptance speech.
My LGBTQIA family, I see each and every one of you. The things that make us different, those are our superpowers. Every day when you walk out the door, put on your imaginary cape and go out there and conquer the world, because the world would not be as beautiful as it is if we weren't in it. And for everybody out there that showed us so much love for this episode, thank you for embracing a little Indian boy from South Carolina and a little queer black girl from the south side of Chicago. We appreciate it more than you could ever know. Thank you, Academy, for this.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 23rd, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
Working 9 to 5. About 98% were yes voters. They hadn't received their ballots yet, but they were extremely excited to send them in straight away with a big yes.
TV dumps on Trump and Aussies push for yes in the postal marriage plebiscite later in the program. But first...
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
A young queer commentator laments the meager global response to homophobic atrocities in the predominantly Muslim region of Russia.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Drew, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Dante talks about the blatant human rights violations in Chechnya, the local autonomous region within Russia. Gay and bisexual men are being outed and turned in by their own families, rounded up and forced into camps, and even executed. This situation highlights the extreme prejudice and homophobia that still exists in much of the developed world.
In the spring of 2017, authorities in Chechnya began rounding up gay and bisexual men. Since then, these men have been beaten, starved, tortured, and in some cases thrown off buildings and killed. There are also reports that the authorities are encouraging family members to report and turn in their gay relatives. In Chechnya and in much of Russia, homophobia is so extreme that the existence of gay people is denied. One authority responded to the allegations, saying, "You cannot arrest or repress people who just do not exist." Chechnya is a Russian-speaking federal republic which identifies itself as a constituent entity of Russia. It is located on the Russian border with Georgia. Around 1 million people are reported to live in Chechnya. The republic is led by Ramzan Kadyrov, a former rebel directly appointed to the Chechen presidency by Russian President Vladimir Putin. Neither Putin nor Kadyrov acknowledges the atrocities being committed. Russian officials deny the existence of a problem, but the U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution on June 27th condemning the activity going on in Chechnya. Alan Lowenthal, a Democratic representative from California, stated, "We, as a nation, must lead the world in acting. It is our duty and responsibility to follow through on the consensus of the House and bring as much domestic and international political pressure as possible on the Russian government to rein in these deplorable human rights violations." On September 1st, The Washington Post reported that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson claimed to have written a letter to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov raising the issue of violence in Chechnya targeting gay men and lesbians. But the State Department has declined to release copies of the letter. And on September 3rd, the New York Times reported that Canada has been working with a Toronto-based nonprofit organization called the Rainbow Railroad to quietly give refuge to queer men and women fleeing Chechnya. As of September, 22 gay men and lesbians from Chechnya have found sanctuary in Canada through the program. In Chechnya, the Russian LGBT network is doing what it can to protect gay and bisexual men. The most it can do at the moment is relocate these men, first to other less dangerous parts of Russia, and eventually out of the country if possible. It's essential for these men to be able to leave Chechnya because their relatives may be hunting them down. In Chechnya, homosexuality carries a stigma for the entire family, and many people react violently against their own relatives. Despite the Russian LGBT network's best efforts, the violence will continue without intervention from the Kremlin. Russia itself has oppressive laws and lacks freedom of speech and the press, so this intervention is unlikely. You don't have to be LGBTQ to recognize what an atrocity this is. What gay and bisexual men living in Chechnya are going through is terrible, and I feel powerless to do anything. In 2016, the Pulse shooting reminded me that, even in this country, LGBT spaces are not above attack. I will never understand what it feels like to be threatened in a place you should feel the most safe, the most able to be yourself. In Chechnya, that threat is everywhere. It is in your government, your neighbors, your family and friends. The election of Donald Trump to the presidency and Republican majorities in both houses of Congress have begun to erode the rights of LGBTQ citizens here at home, but to see a country that actively attacks LGBT people with a government that encourages family members to kill their gay relatives is truly horrifying.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to the show. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out. That was without cue cards, people.
Hello, hello. I like your smile. Hello, hello. Shall we talk a while? Would you like some of my tangerine? I know I'd never treat you mean.
Most eligible voters in Australia have now received their ballots in the government's non-binding marriage equality plebiscite. Even though public opinion polls consistently show overwhelming support for opening civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples, equality advocates worry that many backers won't bother to participate in the non-compulsory vote. This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay reports from Balmain Town Hall in Sydney.
High above the Sydney skyline, a signwriter churned out its stark message, "Vote No." Leader of the Get Up Marriage Equality campaign, Sally Rugg, said in response that the Yes campaign did not need to pay for their advertising as rainbows were free. As you can see, spirits in the Yes campaign here in Australia are high, and I went along to a campaign meeting in the Sydney suburb of Balmain, where the first Australian gay rights movement formed in February 1971. This is an area known to have a high percentage of yes voters, and I asked Jamie Parker, Greens Party State MP for the seat of Balmain, why bother to campaign in areas where there will be such strong support.
Because we know the purpose of the Marriage Equality Postal Survey was to ensure that it wasn't successful. We know that a lot of people will be supporting the Yes campaign, but actually will not fill in the ballot and return it. So we're there to tell people filling in the ballot and returning it is critical.
Madeline Lush is one of the local Yes campaign directors and recently went out door knocking in the nearby suburb of Annandale.
The Australian Marriage Equality Group and a bunch of other like non-partisan groups got together and we did the whole of Annandale and we went off in groups of two or three to go to, like, door knocking honestly, I would say about 98% of people we spoke to were yes voters, and they hadn't received their ballots yet, but they were extremely excited to receive them and send them in straight away with a big yes. So it was really positive. It was great.
Why did you go to an area where you know there was going to be a very big yes vote?
We're going to areas where people are most likely to say yes but need an extra push to get their ballots in.
Alex Greenwich is well known as one of the Yes campaign directors and was recently in the city of Adelaide door knocking as well.
A really positive experience in Adelaide with many people indicating that they will vote yes and talking to us about who they will be voting for, their friends, their family members and their colleagues.
What did you do if you encountered someone who said no?
Well, during the door knocking in the part of Adelaide I was at, I actually didn't encounter any no voters. Everyone was really keen to vote yes and have us move forward.
Many of the attendees at the meeting were not necessarily members of the LGBTIQ community.
So you don't identify as LGBT yourself?
No, I'm a straight and parent. Okay. And married.
What motivates you? You're here with your daughter who's
yes.
in year 9.
Yes.
About 16 years old?
I'm 14.
14
actually.
Years old? Yes. Okay. What has motivated you both to come here tonight to find out more about how to campaign for marriage equality?
I would like to see this yes vote go through. And the biggest risk is, to my way of thinking, is people not actually voting. And so I wanted to come along and see. And I didn't realise it was as dire as what they're thinking about people not voting. But that's the biggest risk. And I want to see what's happening to try and counter that issue.
Talking to your friends at school, is there a high amount of support for marriage equality?
A lot of my friends support marriage equality, and I do have gay friends, and most of us are very much positive for this movement.
But you don't get a vote, do you?
No, we don't get a vote. We're all 14 and younger and a bit older. Yeah, but I think it's still important for young people to be here and learning about this because it is our future and what our friends and family are going through for the next few decades. So it's important still.
Another strategy that the Yes campaign is using is called phone banking. Jamie Parker.
Phone banking is getting communities and individuals together to call numbers to encourage people to fill in their ballot and return it. That's what we're doing across the country, and with that we'll be able to ensure a yes vote.
I spoke to two men at the meeting who were recently involved with phone banking themselves.
The two of us attended the phone banking in Pitt Street at the marriage equality offices. Went for an hour, we sat on the phones, we used our mobiles, it was a 25-cent local call. And it was the wonderful yes response we got from random people we were speaking to. My friend spoke with somebody who said, look, I've got a newborn, I don't have time to speak right now, but just in case they're gay, I'm voting yes, and then hung up. So it's just been an overwhelming response of yes from all sorts of people. We don't know where we're calling, who we're calling. It was any age, any ethnicity, any background, and it was wonderful. Yeah.
What did you do if you got a no response?
We didn't get a no response.
I have a house in Canberra and a house in Sydney. Every Friday I spend 3 to 4 hours driving to Canberra, and I spend 3 to 4 hours driving back every Sunday night or Monday morning. I've made hundreds of calls. Not one single person has said no.
And these were all random calls?
Completely random.
Completely random calls. No one has said no.
You didn't get any nasty responses?
Not a single one.
That's excellent.
Zero.
The same two guys held a yes vote barbecue at their workplace recently.
We're auto body repairers, smash repairers, collision repairers, and we basically put on a yes barbecue where everyone can bring their vote in, and then we'll mail them for them. And we've got a very multicultural, multi-faith workforce. Over 50 people that worked for the company, there was one person who chose to abstain from voting. If you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. You don't have to send the vote back in. You don't have to say no, even if you don't want to say yes.
Back to traditional door knocking, what approach was used? Madeline Lush.
We were given a very well thought out script by Australian Marriage Equality. I mean, they're very professional in knowing how to talk to people. So we had a brief training beforehand that was very well distributed, and then we just went with that. But just being friendly and talking to people and remembering that everyone's human, so.
What do you think is going to be the outcome in November?
Yes, a big yes.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. No worries.
I'm Barry Mackay in Balmain in Sydney for This Way Out.
According to the latest opinion polls, negative campaigning by the It's Okay to Say No forces have successfully started to erode voter support for equality. And there are increasing reports of ballot tampering and outright fraud. While most young Aussie voters are expected to favor marriage equality, their challenge might be to find or even recognize a postbox. Some told the UK's Times newspaper that they've never mailed a postal letter in their lives. But the report quotes 19-year-old Sydney University student Emily Bocker. "My dad will know," she said. Check out www.yes.org.au. And finally this week,
poor little rich boy ain't got nothing but lots and lots of money. Poor little rich boy don't take nothing but some sad poor boy's money. Rides around all day with fancy clothes in a big long limousine. Poor little rich boy ain't got nothing but everything.
Pity U.S. President Donald Trump. He just can't catch a break. In the first of two examples, TV's Ellen DeGeneres tells guest Megyn Kelly, who said she'd welcome him on her new talk show, why she wouldn't. And earlier in the week at the 69th Annual Emmy Awards, out Lily Tomlin and ally Jane Fonda reunited with queer-supportive silent partner Dolly Parton to score what was probably the sharpest Trump thumping of the night.
You know, he has his Twitter account and he has ways to get his message across. There's nothing I'm going to say to him that's going to change him. And I don't want to give him a platform because it's just, it validates him. Yeah. And I can't have someone that I feel is not only dangerous for the country and for me personally as a gay woman, but as to the world. He's dividing all of us. And I think I don't want to I don't want him on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1980, in that movie, we refused to be controlled by a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot. Really? And in 2017, we still refuse to be controlled by a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot.
Boy, boy, ain't got nothing but everything.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Christopher Gall and Francis O'Brien, produced by Steve Pride, and from Outcasters Drew and Dante, produced by Mark Sulfis. Simon and Garfunkel, Sopwith Camel, and George Jones performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This layout thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WMBR Cambridge, Massachusetts, KGIG Modesto, California, CJMP Powell River, British Columbia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
The studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA and KPFA.org. My name is C.S. Song. Alan Watts was deeply interested in and engaged with Eastern thought and philosophy. He was a philosopher, a sought-after lecturer, and the author of more than two dozen books. Alan Watts was most prominently an influential interpreter of Eastern philosophy, comparing it to, and to some degree integrating it into, emerging Western modes of thought and understanding. Watts's message was spread by, among other outlets, KPFA, on which Alan Watts hosted a radio program for two decades beginning in 1953. That seems like a long time ago, and yet there's something both deep and timeless about Watts's thoughts and words, and today we are pleased to present portions of two talks by Alan Watts that are part of the Alan Watts Library Collection, compiled by the Pacifica Radio Archives and comprising 28 hours of audio, of broadcasts and seminars and talks that Alan Watts gave over the course of 20 years. 28 hours of Alan Watts on three MP3 CDs are yours as a thank you gift for a $180 pledge, which comes to $30 a month over 6 months, to this listener-supported radio station. The phone numbers to call are, well, actually, there's just one. It's 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And if you ever forget those numbers, you can just remember 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We are also offering the magisterial Alan Watts combo pack, and that includes the Alan Watts Library Collection, all 28 hours on three MP3 CDs, plus a set of three films about Alan Watts. Three films about Alan Watts, plus the Alan Watts Library Collection, yours for a dollar a day, plus pledge to KPFA, a dollar a day to KPFA, $365 pledge to KPFA. It's about $60 a month over 6 months, and you get not just the 28 hours of Alan Watts, but you get three films, which were, by the way, put together by Mark Watts, who is Alan Watts' son. That's a $365 pledge to KPFA. Let's turn now to one of the selections on this Alan Watts Super PAC, this library collection. It's called Reconciliation of Opposites.
It's always interesting to me to see how often psychologists and psychotherapists talk about the problem of reconciling opposites. Anybody who knows anything at all about the elementary principles, say, of psychoanalysis, knows that according to the ideas of both Freud and Jung, that according to their ideas, there is a kind of compensatory relationship between what is conscious and what is unconscious in our mental life. And that to the degree that one is, as it were, light above, one is dark below, or to the degree that one is dark above, one is light below. And it's often pointed out that very many people who wrote the most scurrilous books, such as Rabelais, led the most exemplary lives. Whereas, on the other hand, a lot of people who wrote very pious and holy books actually led disreputable lives. And I think there is a great deal of truth in the way Freud so often points out that what is expressed in the world of dreams is the opposite side of life to that which one is living consciously. And that, therefore, the problem of integrating a person, of making him whole, and it's interesting, isn't it, that the word whole is etymologically related to the word holy, but the problem of making a person whole is to get together his two apparently opposed sides. And underneath all this, there is the recognition that so many things which seem at one level to be opposed to each other are at another level mutually necessary. And this is something that's terribly difficult for us to admit. We don't like to uncover the basic harmony which very often underlies things that we would rather prefer to see in opposition to each other. Take, for example, the fundamental opposition of life and death. Isn't it perfectly extraordinary the way we manage to conceal, or most people manage to conceal, the fact that they keep alive by death day in and day out? After all, we are constantly transforming dead animals and plants into the shape of our own organisms. But all this kind of thing, you know, is conveniently put away. The slaughterhouse is somewhere in a back district of Chicago, and we just don't get to see what goes on. And, of course, we conceal death in so many ways. The whole art of the mortician, as he likes to style himself, is to conceal death. And therefore, because death is constantly repressed, we begin to forget how much life and death go together. And so, if to the degree that we fail to recognize the inseparability of things that we call opposites, to that degree, we keep running into problems that baffle us and that we don't understand. We don't understand, for example, how necessary our enemies are to us. How the things that we fight against are things which stimulate us and call out our energies. And while, in other words, it seems to be necessary to muster all our strength to oppose certain things, if we should overdo it and muster too much strength and succeed in getting rid of our enemies, we might very well collapse. And so something of this kind underlies the very, very usual idea in Eastern philosophy of the truth lying in the middle. In other words, in Confucianism, one of the cardinal principles of Confucianism is the so-called doctrine of the mean. And interpreted at one level, this is rather just a platitudinous doctrine of moderation, that one should be moderate in all things. And in the same way, Buddhism is called the middle way. And that too, at a certain low level of interpretation, means nothing more than that this is a doctrine of moderation. But that is only part of the point, because what the middle way really comes to is not moderation, it isn't compromise, but really a profound understanding of the unity that underlies all oppositions. You know, so often we think logically that life consists fundamentally in oppositions, that, as it were, conflict is the most fundamental reality that there is. We look upon life, in other words, as an encounter. This happens in all sorts of different ways. The encounter of spirit and matter, the encounter of mind and body, and also the encounter of oneself and the world. As if these things came from unimaginable distances apart and suddenly met each other, and by reason of being, as it were, logically opposed to each other, there is thereupon conflict. But obviously, there can't be a battle unless there's a battlefield. It's often said it's very difficult to arrange a battle between a tiger and a shark because they have no common field. Wherever there is a battle, preceding the conflict, prior to it, underlying it, is something in common. As the very fact that two people who are having a fight have something in common, that there's something they both want to get, and so are fighting over it. What they want to get, they have in common. And because they have the same desire, they are the same kind of creature, they have that life in common. And so underlying every contest, there is a fundamental agreement, as in Alice, Tweedledum and Tweedledee agreed to have a battle. So the real meaning of the middle way, and Buddhism is often simply called the middle way, is to go down underneath conflict to discover harmony.
That's Alan Watts, the philosopher, lecturer, author, KPFA broadcaster at one point, actually more than at one point. He was a KPFA broadcaster for 20 years, influential interpreter of Eastern thought and philosophy. We'll get back to more of the content, the almost overwhelming in its sheer abundance content of the Alan Watts Library Collection. But I just want to mention again what we have on offer on this, the last hour that Sasha and I will be coming to you, this fund drive to ask your support specifically for Against the Grain and what we do 3 days a week. The thank you gifts are the entire 28-hour 3 MP3 CD Alan Watts Library Collection, 28 hours of Alan Watts for a discounted pledge rate of $180 to KPFA. 28 hours for $180. That's your thank you gift, and that comes out to $30 a month over the course of 6 months if you prefer to do it that way. And you don't have to pay all your installments before you get this library collection, so simply talk to the phone volunteers. And then we have this lovely Alan Watts combo pack today, and that includes the Alan Watts library collection plus a set of three films about Alan Watts and his ideas and his life. One is a film by his son, Mark Watts, called Why Not Now. The second film is a lot of material that Mark could not fit into his film, Why Not Now. So this is sort of bonus footage, but a lot of it. And the third film in that pack is an animated film about Alan Watts and his ideas. And I understand that a South Park animator contributed to that, or I should say played a major role in creating that animated film. So those three films plus the Alan Watts Library Collection, yours for a dollar a day to KPFA. That's about $60 a month over 6 months, or $365 in one fell swoop if you want to do it that way. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $180 or $30 a month gets you the Alan Watts Library Collection, 28 hours, the Alan Watts Combo Pack with the Library Collection and the three DVDs, not one, but three films about Alan Watts and his ideas, yours for a dollar a day to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You're saying, hey, KPFA, I like what you do. I like what you give me. I like what you provide me. I like what you do for me. I like how you make me think. I like how you open up new vistas. I like how you present alternative perspectives. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also donate online at kpfa.org. And just a few biographical notes about Alan Watts that maybe even some of you who have heard his voice on KPFA over the years don't know. He was born in England on January 6th, 1915, and from 1934 to 1938, he edited the Buddhist Lodge of London's journal, The Middle Way, and his first book, The Spirit of Zen, appeared in 1936. He came to the U.S. in 1939. He arrived in New York, studied under a local Zen master, Soke An Sasaki. He received his Master of Sacred Theology degree in Illinois in 1948. He was ordained an Episcopal priest, but then he left the church. In an interview in Life magazine, in 1961, Watts said that he left the church not because it doesn't practice what it preaches, but because it preaches. He went on to teach comparative philosophy and psychology at the American Academy of Asian Studies, so-called at that point, in San Francisco. And he worked, among other things, on a number of things. I mean, he wrote a number of books, a number of best-selling books, and he was, for a time, director and writer of the National Education Television, the NET series, Eastern Wisdom and Modern Life. Alan Watts, 28 hours of Alan Watts in, digestible chunks. These are lectures and seminars and talks and radio programs. Each one is about half an hour long, and some of them are an hour long. So you can sit down with it, listen to 50, half an hour or an hour at a time or whatever you like. There's a ton of wisdom in this Alan Watts Library Collection, yours for a $180 pledge to KPFA. And if you want the combo pack of the Library Collection and the three DVD set, three films about Alan Watts, yours for a dollar a day to KPFA. If you want just the films, by the way, because some people just like to watch stuff, and I certainly like to watch stuff. You can get the 3D DVDs for a $250 pledge to KPFA. These are your thank you gifts. You're giving to hopefully something you care about and you want to support. We are in the last 24 hours. We're in the last 24 hours of KPFA's Fall Fund Drive. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Give us a call. We go now to a clip from another selection on this Alan Watts Library Collection. This lecture, this talk by Alan Watts is entitled Parallel Thoughts, East and West.
I've often drawn attention to a curious distinction between Chinese and typically Western attitudes to human nature. We are reared in the West with a rather fundamental mistrust of our own nature. To use a Platonic analogy, we think of man as a sort of rider on a horse, a two-natured person who has a rational soul and an animal body. And the animal body is regarded as something vital but stupid, in charge of the rational soul, whose origins seem to be completely independent of those of the animal body. And so the whole problem and the task of human life is to subjugate the animal body to the rational will. Now, therefore, it is somewhat alien to the West and to Western traditions of thought to see any sanity in putting trust in the wisdom of one's own animal nature. Now, of course, there were tendencies in this direction that arose in the 18th century and strengthened in the 19th century in what we call philosophy of nature and later the romantic movement in literature. These, say, were associated with the work of Rousseau, for example, with his philosophy of the noble savage, the idea that man was by nature free, and as a result of the superimpositions of artificial social structures, has been found everywhere in chains. We are, I think, beginning to come to a point of view whereby we must recognize that although human nature is not something which, if, as it were not interfered with, would be entirely good, which is, I think, roughly the romantic point of view, but rather to say something like this: the human nature, as we find it, is an interplay, a balance of good and evil, of positive and negative, and that sanity consists in respecting this balance. See, this is not a sentimental point of view. It does not ignore the fact, for example, that we live by destroying other organisms, that there is inevitable conflict in life in its natural state, but that this conflict is something which subserves a higher kind of harmony, and therefore has to be trusted, or rather has to be supported, accepted, and contained, and that sanity consists fundamentally in this. Now then, on the basis of this sort of attitude to human nature, there has been developed a kind of movement in the West, you could hardly call it a movement in any organized sense, which seems to have originated in Germany. Some years ago in Germany, there was a woman called Elsa Gindler, and she happened to have a serious case of tuberculosis. Her doctors told her, at that time, many years ago, she died at the age of 70, about 2 or 3 years ago, that she was a hopeless case. There was nothing further they could do for her, and that she may as well get ready for the end. She therefore betook herself, I think, to the Black Forest, and found herself a quiet little hut where she could live in the forest alone. And she said, if this disease came by itself, it can go by itself. And she decided to make an experiment. that she would become as vividly aware as she could of all the subtle motions that were going on inside her body, all the subtle little feelings that she had, and she would respond to them. And so, in the quiet of the forest, she became silent and very, very responsive to everything that was going on within her, in the kind of inner life of her organism. And by doing this, after about a year had passed, she found herself recovered from the disease. And this so fascinated her that she explored further the promptings of her own nature and explored ways of teaching it to other people and eventually developed a kind of system of instructing others in this art. But nobody was ever able to think up a kind of label or name for what this art is. Of course, the Chinese would say this is the art of Taoism. This is the art that is called in Chinese Wu Wei, or non-interference with the Tao, that is to say, with the course of nature. But you see, in describing the way that Elsa Gindler went about this, you can see at once that non-interference is a highly difficult thing requiring a great deal of intelligence. So you have to be patient, you have to be intelligent, you have to be sensitive in order to respond to these subtle promptings of the organism itself. It's a fascinating experiment in simply becoming ever more aware of one's physical organism and learning to trust it and learning to become in accord consciously with what it wants to do, and that wish or that want is ordinarily unconscious. And therefore, it's something that's very difficult to explain without actually participating in it, without doing it. Perhaps I might introduce this by a story which Charlotte Selver once told me about herself and her study with Elsa Gindler. One of the things that Elsa Gindler tried sometimes to get her students to do was to make a drawing of the way in which one feels one's own body. And when Charlotte first went to study with her, she was full of all kinds of funny ideas, and when she was asked to draw how she feels, she made a grand drawing of everything about herself that she knew intellectually, you see, that she had. All her bones and muscles and everything were put there in the right position. There were several people in the class, and when all the drawings were put up along the wall, Charlotte Selver was astonished to see that none of the other drawings looked in the least bit like her own. They were all kinds of funny lines and blotches and blobs, and indeed one of them was simply a blank piece of paper with a small black spot on it. And she said that Elsa Gindler walked along the drawings, making various comments about them, and when she came to the one with the black spot, she said, "Oh, I see you still have that tension in your left hip." And Charlotte was expecting, you see, that at the time that Elsa Gindler arrived at her, she would compliment her on what a really sensitive drawing she had done of her own body. But when she finally approached that drawing, she said nothing and passed right on. And that was a great moment. That was one of those moments of truth in life, those moments of conversion, when one finds out the difference between what you think you feel and what you really feel. One of the things most strongly emphasized in this work is that we're all brought up to try and conform ourselves to fixed patterns of what a human being ought to be. This happens in very many different ways. But one of the ways in which it happens is how we ought to move and hold ourselves physically. We talk about postures. What is the right way to sit? The right way to stand? The right way to use one's hands, and so on and so forth. And of course, it doesn't strike us that all these things are very stylized. And if they don't correspond in any way with what our physical organism actually wants to do, the adoption of these stylized postures is going to cause conflict between what we try to be and what we are. And since what we try to be has really no special virtue about it, a lot of the postures that we adopt have no particular sense to them at all. They're sort of social rituals. I want to quote from Charlotte Selver's article in the General Semantics Bulletin, a little story. She says, "The other day I visited some friends. Among the guests there was a couple with their daughter, a little girl of 8, a thoughtful and very graceful child. While we were talking, the little girl played in the garden. I had the pleasure of watching her through the window. Then she came upstairs and sat down, one leg hanging down, the other one on the couch. Mother said, 'But Helen, how do you sit? Take your leg off the couch. A girl never should sit like that.' The little girl took her leg down, on which occasion her skirt flew high above her knees. The mother: 'Helen, pull your skirt down. One can see everything.' The child blushed, looked down on herself and pulled her skirt down, but asked, 'Why? What is wrong?' The mother looked at her quite shocked and said, 'One doesn't do that.' By this time, the atmosphere in the room was completely uncomfortable. The little girl not only had her legs down, but had them pressed against each other. Her shoulders had gone up and she held her arms tight against her little body. This went on until she couldn't stand it any longer. She suddenly stretched herself and yawned heartily. Again, a storm of indignation from her mother. By now, this all lasted about 10 minutes, the child had changed completely. Her gracefulness had turned into awkwardness. All her motions were stilled. Her little body was tense. She hardly seemed to be alive anymore. What will happen to this child? She will hold her unhappy pose for a few minutes before she shakes it off. The next time, her mother will admonish her. She will hold it a few minutes longer, and so on, each time a little longer, until at last she will have repressed her naturalness so deeply that she will have forgotten it. The mother will then have reached her goal. She will have educated her to be socially acceptable. As a human being, the child will be greatly inhibited, because as the mother will chain her in this direction, she will chain her in 1,000 other directions." End of quote. And so you see, it isn't simply in the social conditioning of the child. It's not simply a matter of training children in the fundamental conventions of moral behavior, which perhaps are artificial, but certainly are necessary for some sort of social cohesion and agreement. But the training of children in all kinds of weird symbolic attitudes, which are held to be proper and nice and ritualistically decent, which produces in all of us a state of chronic psychophysical strain and discomfort, which after a while becomes unconscious. We fail to notice it, but it underlies our ulcers and our irritations and our frustrations, which eventually build up into our vast and appalling political idiocies.
Alan Watts, the philosopher, the author. His books have been translated into at least 11 languages. The lecturer, the sought-after presenter, the veteran KPFA broadcaster. He hosted a KPFA radio program for 20 years, beginning in 1953. The influential interpreter of Eastern thought and a philosopher, considered one of the major figures who brought Eastern philosophy and thought to the West, Joseph Campbell. The great scholar of mythology and religion and philosophy praised Alan Watts' efforts to convey the history and development of Eastern thought. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain, and Sasha Lilly is nearby. And we have some more Alan Watts to present to you, so don't go anywhere. But since this is the last day of Against the Grain coming to you during this KPFA's Fall Fun Drive, we have been given a match for the next 5 minutes. So for the next 5 minutes, we have been asked to raise $500 by Reed Stockton from Forest Knolls, California. I just looked that up, and that is in an unincorporated community in Marin County, California. Lovely to learn about new places in the Bay Area and beyond. And Elaine P. from Oakland. That's her initial, Elaine P. from Oakland. Reed Stockton and Elaine P. have put up $500 conditionally, but they will match you only over the course of the next 4 minutes. So if you call 1-800-439-5732, that's 1-800-439-5732, and you ask for the Alan Watts Library Collection, all 28 hours of Alan Watts on this 3 MP3 CD set for a $180 pledge, we get $360 because of Reed Stockton and Elaine P. and you. So you can join and have your dollars doubled, 1-800-439-5732. For a $30 a month pledge for 6 months, you get this Alan Watts Library Collection, or you can pledge $180 altogether at one time, and we get double that amount. If you want, and somebody's already gone for this, the Alan Watts Combo Pack, which is the Alan Watts Library Collection, all 28 hours of him talking about all kinds of things, plus the set of three films about Alan Watts. It's called Why Not Now, and it's a set of three DVDs. You get all that for a dollar a day to KPFA. It's about $60 a month over 6 months. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. I've been known to present a fair amount of philosophy on this program. Eastern philosophy, Western philosophy, philosophy of all kinds, philosophy that I find to be relevant to the current juncture, the historical juncture, the political juncture, the psychosocial juncture that we are in. And if you appreciate that, and if you want a whole lot of really practical philosophy, Eastern philosophy and Western, he also talks quite a bit about Western philosophy in this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection. You can get that at the deeply discounted pledge rate of $180 to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge online at kpfa.org, kpfa.org, and then you can choose among all kinds of things we've offered during this KPFA Fall Fun Drive, which ends again tomorrow in less than 24 hours. It ends at noon tomorrow. And so there's a special urgency because we still have to raise about $49,000. And that's a lot to make, but we can do it, and that allows KPFA to soldier on, to keep going for another few months. And so it's all about you. It's not about corporations. It's not about corporate foundations. It's not about underwriting. It's not about other people doing what KPFA listeners do. It's about all of you collectively out there standing in solidarity with KPFA, making a statement about who you are and about what you support when you call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. There's a lot of Buddhism in this Alan Watts Library Collection for a $180 pledge, which is doubled for the next, minute. There is conversations about Hinduism. There's conversation about Western thought and Western philosophy and Western thinkers like Paul Tillich and Aldous Huxley and C.G. Jung. And there's a lot about Asian culture. There's talk about psychoanalysis, There is a memorial tribute to Alan Watts. There is talk about, next time I'm on the air, I'll read you some of these titles of many of these, but there's some stuff about Christian philosophy, Eastern Orthodox spirituality, fundamentals of Eastern philosophy, of course, discussion of Buddhist mysticism, parallel thoughts East and West. And speaking of that, and I'll go check and see whether we've made that match, I want to present to you a couple minutes of this excerpt, of this additional portion from the Alan Watts excerpt. It's called Alan Watts Talk. It's called Parallel Thoughts East and West. Please keep calling 1-800-439-5732.
It's very difficult to get people to recover from this because, you see, in trying to come back to themselves, to come back to a unity and harmony with their own organisms, they still have the cast of mind, the tendency, to look to authority of some kind to tell them what they ought to be. And Charlotte Selver has often told me that people who come to work with her expect to be told what kind of physical posture, what kind of physical feelings they ought to have. She says they want to know how to move, how to stand, how to sit. Or, in order to be exercised, they're quite astonished at first when they're invited to become more restful, to give up the doing, so that they can listen better to what their body has to tell them. We need quiet for self-experience, quiet and awakeness. We need permissiveness, too, to all the subtle changes which may be needed. We ask, therefore, what can one feel of one's own organism? What of happenings within, not what one knows of one's body or what one thinks about it or believes somebody else expects one to feel of it, but what one actually senses, no matter what comes to the fore. But this is difficult, of course, because we expect that we are supposed to conform to a pattern and that there is somebody who knows what we ideally ought to be, ought to feel.
Yes, thanks, Erica. That is Alan Watts, and I am CS, and Sasha sits alongside, and we are in the last 14 minutes of KPFA's fund drive as it pertains to us, as it pertains to raising money for Against the Grain to keep this program going and on the air. And we've got some lovely thank you gifts. That was Alan Watts, the philosopher and very prominent interpreter of Eastern thought for Western audiences. And for a $180 pledge to KPFA, which you can break down into six equal monthly installments of $30, you get the Alan Watts Library Collection. And that is not 2 hours of Alan Watts, and that is not 10 hours or 15 hours or 20, that's 28 hours. 28 hours of Alan Watts with his hypnotic voice, his amazing storytelling ability, his abundance of insights. And you get that for a $180 pledge, 28 hours, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. If you've been waiting, if you've been hemming, if you've been hawing, you've been procrastinating, you've been thinking, oh, when the fund drive ends, I'll get on board. As well, we're almost there, folks, because there's less than 24 hours now to KPFA's fall fund drive. In fact, we're ending it early for you because we want to give you more of what you expect from KPFA, more of the regular programming. We're ending this a day and a half earlier. Management made that decision last week, so maybe you want to even support that decision. Support yourself not just with the library collection, but if you want and if you can afford, the Alan Watts combo pack, this amazing combo pack, which not only has 28 hours of audio of Alan Watts, but three films about Alan Watts made by his son, Mark Watts, who I've talked to and met, a lovely person who is really devoted to disseminating the ideas of his father. You can get that 3-DVD set about Alan Watts, a film, then bonus footage that they couldn't fit into the film. That takes up another separate DVD. There's a lot there, plus an animated film, the animated Alan Watts. That's all of that. The 3 DVDs and this library collection is yours for $1 a day to KPFA. Alan Watts, his books, as I mentioned, have been translated into at least 11 languages. He spoke about Buddhism and about Eastern thought in ways that really grabbed people. His radio program on KPFA beginning in 1953 was tremendously popular, and he is about helping us move beyond the kind of struggling and striving and squirming and anxiety feeling and conflict-ridden lives that we often lead. And he's trying to get us to think unconventionally, to think beyond the ways in which we have been taught to think. We've been socialized in certain ways. We've been conditioned in certain ways. We've been propagandized in many ways. And he wants us to look at what is truly essential to our well-being and peace of mind and health, physical health, mental health, emotional health. Alan Watts helps to point the way, not just in the excerpts we play, but in the vast 28-hour Alan Watts library collection. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I want to say we made that match earlier this hour, so I thank you so much to everybody who called and pledged online at kpfa.org. But then, since it is our last day, our last time with you this fun drive during this regular Against the Grain hour, we've been given, Sasha, you're not going to believe it, is a $1,000 match.
Wow.
A $1,000 match.
That's
from
formidable.
Two real flesh and blood people, as are all the people who put up matches and who give to KPFA. Michael Bickler, or Bitchler, I'm going to say Bickler, in Petaluma, California, the North Bay. Yeah, again. And John Buenfil, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. John Buenfil, I think that's in French, it's like good son. Interesting. Concord. John Buenfil in Concord. Michael Bichler or Bickler in Petaluma. They've put up $1,000, but it's conditional, and they will match you dollar for dollar collectively for the next 9.5 minutes, and then that's it. So if we can make $1,000 from you all out there, then we get $1,000 from John and Michael. It's as simple as that. $1,000 from you folks out there, we get $1,000 from John and Michael. And so that means your dollars are doubled. You know, essentially, it means your dollars are doubled. And if you want this 28-hour collection for $180 pledge, again, we get $360. If you want the $365 dollar a day Alan Watts combo pack, we get double that, $730. And this is really, really, really important because, again, we have to make about $50,000 before noon tomorrow. And, you know, management keeps track, so every dollar we make during this hour really counts for us. It counts toward management's understanding of what Against the Grain brings to KPFA's airwaves and brings to people like you who are still hearing my voice and who want some Eastern thought and philosophy and mysticism and ecology and music and poetry and ethics. So many, many topics that are part of this Alan Watts library collection for $180. So double your money, 1-800-439-5732.
And there's only 8 minutes left to do that. The challenge expires in 8 minutes, so we're really hoping that you'll go to your phones right now or go to your computer and pledge, because as CS said, this is the last time the two of us are going to come to you in this time slot to raise money for Against the Grain before this fund drive is over. So we'd really like to go out with a bang. If you appreciate the work of CS, then think about this as a vote for him, because as he mentioned earlier, he does bring a lot of programming about philosophy to the air. I think that's something that you just don't find anywhere else. And I'm grateful to him because I learn a lot from his programming. If you feel like you do too, or if you're appreciative that there's a space on these airwaves, these public airwaves, for that deeper probing understanding about the world, the lives we live, then please make your vote right now by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or easy to remember is 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also go to kpfa.org. And, of course, your dollars are doubled right now, so no better time to call and pledge. And I guess I'd just like to say generally, you know, I was thinking about how Alan Watts, whose style is just entrancing, listening to him, you just, you know, want to stop everything and be sort of pulled along by his narrative and his ideas. But that kind of deeper thinking, that probing thinking, is something that has been with KPFA since its founding. And yet, I don't think we should take it for granted, because it is so scarce and so rare in the rest of the media. I would even venture including the alternative media, much of it. So if it's something you appreciate, deeper analysis, the probing, philosophical or historical look at the world around us, then register your support right now by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And let me just remind you that your donation is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. It's a wonderful way to divert some of your taxes away from the military and toward this institution that was founded by pacifists in the depths of the Cold War. 1-800-439-5732. There is an $800 match, $1,000 match. I'm still boggled by the immensity of this match. A challenge of $1,000 is on the line. We have a bit over 5 minutes to go. We really hope we can make it, because after this, Against the Grain doesn't come to you in a fund drive program for a long time. We will, of course, resume regular programming next week. But we'd love to hear from you right now and be able to make some of the necessary money toward this $50,000, which is left to make in KPFA's fund drive in the next 24 hours.
1-800-439-5732. $30 a month over 6 months gets you the 28 hours of Alan Watts. $60 over 6 months, about a little more than that, gets you the Alan Watts combo pack, the films, and the Alan Watts library collection. You know, this guy wrote more than 25 books. He wrote more than 25 books. His programs consisted of lectures. His programs on KPFA consisted of lectures, of substantive talks by Alan Watts. Many of these talks are in, well, almost, I imagine most of his talks are in this 28-hour sprawling collection. He talks about Taoism, which interests me as well, about technology, about the possibility of human extinction, about the about basic ideas of Hinduism, always very thoughtful and deep and eloquent. And he is pointing out the fact that we are wired to think in certain ways, and as a result to ignore many things, many aspects of ourselves and our existence, to devalue many aspects of ourselves and our existence, some of which are absolutely essential to our well-being. 1-800-439-5732. You can think about what we've been doing on Against the Grain. You can think about what you've appreciated from Alan Watts, maybe listening to this hour of Alan Watts, and maybe listening to prior presentations of Alan Watts's recordings. And you can also give less than $180. There are all kinds of thank you gifts. You just call 1-800-439-5732. You still get your dollars doubled, and you can get your KPFA T-shirt if you want. You can get the KPFA water bottle. There are all kinds of thank you gifts at any level, anything you can afford. It's a gesture that you're making. It's an important gesture. It's an important action. It's a vote for what Alan Watts is presenting, which is unconventional ways of thinking, thinking against the grain, with the grain, thinking with the grain of the way, the Tao, of the path, of the way things are and move naturally. 1-800-439-5732. Sasha, we can make this match. I want to thank Julia. Another person from Forest Knowles, California called. That's fantastic. Thank you so much. Sarah from Alameda, David in San Francisco,
Sarah.
Sam in San Jose, Virginia in Richmond, California, Will in San Francisco, Max from Berkeley, Maxim from Berkeley. Join these people. You still have 2.5 minutes.
Yes, we're so grateful to those generous listeners. We hope you will join them right now by calling 1-800-439-5732 when we have this $1,000 match on the line. Your dollars are doubled up to $1,000. Please give as generously as you can on this final hour for us of Against the Grain during this fund drive. If you can afford to give at the $365 rate, a dollar a day to KPFA, please think about doing that. If you can pledge at $500 or $1,000, we'd be grateful as well. But now is the time. Now is the time to act. 1-800-439-5732. And if there are lots of wonderful thank you gifts, there's so much Alan Watts here, and we'd love to be able to share it with you. But if you'd just like to donate and say no thank you gift, well, my big thank you here is KPFA. We're grateful to that. However much you can give, if you can't afford that much, we totally understand. We just are hoping that you'll come through. You're kind of taking a stand right now for us, and we know it. We see all the names that come up, and it really warms the cockles of our hearts here on Against the Grain. So please do your part. We have just over a minute left to go. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. We just have 60 seconds left, CS. Still, we don't know if we made the match. Please put us over the top. Call right now.
I'm pretty sure we haven't made it, so every dollar you give is still doubled. You can make this call. It's an important call. Alan Watts wants you to, quote, cease to be bothered by false problems. He says we're often asking the wrong questions. Get his ideas. Get his insights. 1-800-439-5732. Give as generously as you can. Give and get. Give and get an amazing thank you gift, an amazing set of thank you gifts if you want the dollar a day Alan Watts combo packs, films, and talks to keep you occupied and interested and enlightened for a long, long time. It's a great thank you gift. We've got 10 seconds to go. You can still keep calling. I don't know whether we made that match, but I appreciate everyone who's called and supported Against the Grain. If you keep calling, you'll still support us.